to order.
Here we are.
Madam Chair,
your turn.
The Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue will come to order.
And thank you all for coming today. We're looking forward to hearing about the economic and revenue forecast. And it's great to see so many familiar faces again today, and committee members, as well as people who are here to study Oregon's economy. Madam Chair, do you have an opening remark you'd like to make?
Well, just to say I'm very happy to be here. This is a new assignment for me, and I'm used to looking out to a sea of lawyers, and now I have a different kind of group I'm looking out at. I'm very excited about being on chair of this committee, and especially excited about the people I'm working with on both the House and Senate side. So to be continued, and I'm very happy to be here.
Great. Paul?
We're in our new quarters, but we're happy to get a chance to come back over the Capitol for a day.
I've heard some remarks along that line before, haven't I? Should we go ahead with our agenda? Release of September economic and revenue forecast. Gentlemen.
Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Back, Office of Economic Analysis. I'm the acting state economist. Here is Michael Kennedy. He is our senior economist. We're here today to report to you the September 2007 economic and revenue forecast. In our forecast, we're assisted by various state agencies in data collection and analysis. And we also solicit input from three advisory committees: Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, Bass Economic Advisory Committee, and finally, Council of Revenue Advisors. We finalize the numbers using econometric models, but in the end, we use our forecaster judgment. Despite all the inputs we get from various sources, we are the only one who is responsible for the numbers that we put out. If you look back on May's forecast, these are the assumptions that we made. We expected the consumers where we land, and consumer spending is slowing. And business investment will resume and stay healthy, and it's happening. And in the past 3-4 months, global economy continued to grow, and it's helping Oregon's manufacturing and agricultural sector. We expected some weak expansion, and it's happening. Personal income growth, we thought that would be subdued in growth, reflecting subdued employment growth. In May, we saw balanced risk, and we didn't see any recession coming. And overall, we expected slower job gains. Recent developments are in line with our May forecast, both nationally and in Oregon. But what we're seeing these days that we didn't see in May is credit crunch and financial market volatility. We've witnessed housing meltdown and ensuing credit crunch. Now, this credit crunch is spread all over globally, and we saw European central banks injecting a ton of money, and also we saw the Federal Reserve System here being very active. Now, there is a good chance that this credit crunch will be resolved within the financial system, but we cannot rule out the possibility that there will be some economic fallout from this credit crunch. We have elevated oil prices, and And this morning, oil price is rising because of hurricane news. The market is expecting that the Fed would cut interest rate in September, and that is priced in market activity, and could be well justified because inflation rate is under control. Recent economic developments in Oregon. We have stable unemployment rate. We had a little bit of increase in unemployment rate in July. But if you look at unemployment initial benefit claims, it's very stable. But at the same time, you see a lot less job being created. Total non-farm employment grew 1.4% year over year in the second quarter. And that was a 0.9% growth quarter over quarter. Personal income growth was revised up for 2006. That's on par with the national growth. By the way, one of the reasons that we have big kicker check that Michael Kennedy will talk about is that we anticipated strong growth in 2005 and early part of 2006 when we put out the 2005 forecast. But we didn't quite anticipate that the economy would stay very strong until the end of 2006. And we are constantly surprised by resilient national and Oregon economy. Housing starts tumbled in the second quarter, year over year. It's about 22% down. That's about the same as national downturn in housing starts. House appreciation rate is decelerating. At the state level, it's about 7-8%. But we see wide divergence of growth rate differences. In Medford and Bend, the growth rate is very, very low at this point. But in other parts of metro areas, still growth rate is relatively high. In Salem area, it's over 10% year over year. But if you look at five-year average, Salem area is not the highest. We have to talk about Bend and Medford. For the economic forecast, we're going to look at leading indicators, and because our economy is strongly affected by the national economy and the global economy, we're going to take a look at the U.S. economic forecast and global economic conditions. Particularly, we'll look at housing sector and business capital spending that have huge impact on our economy. We're going to give you our baseline forecast and alternative scenarios. If you look at both U.S. and Oregon economic indicators, they all tell us that slow growth is ahead of us. That hasn't changed for quite some time. But if you look at U.S. index, that index doesn't reflect current credit problems. So we see a little bit of downturn in U.S. index, and again, there is a possibility that credit problem may spread over to real sector of the economy. And this is to give you how this Oregon index leading economic indicators tell us. The green line is the indicator, and the shaded gray line is average 6-month annualized employment growth rate. If you look at U.S. economic growth by sector, we see very slow economic growth. So real GDP, gross domestic product, would increase below trend. We're looking at about 3% as trend growth. That's increase in labor force plus productivity growth. Now, for 2007 and 8, we're going to see subpar performance before we go over the trend in 2009. We're talking about U.S. economic growth. In the past, consumption led the growth together with residential construction. We're not going to see spectacular contribution from residential investment. And consumption is rather subdued. But if you look at business investment, it's strong, and the size of business investment is about 2.5 times the size of residential investment. So even though you see a little lower number for business fixed investment, its contribution to economic growth is huge.
Excuse me just a moment.
Yes.
Are these numbers reflecting the change in the rate of growth or something else?
Mr. Chair, this is the rate of growth.
So when we see a negative number in residential investment, we're talking about a decline in the growth rate.
Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
Now, if you look at exports, we see a blockbuster performance, and actually that's helping our Oregon's manufacturing and agriculture sector. Of course, housing is the major drag on U.S. growth, and if you look at the red line, that's the economic growth excluding residential investment. So in the past, we had substantial contribution, in fact, almost leading the economic growth, talking about residential investment. But since 2006, you see negative contribution by residential investment. We continue to see robust business investment spending, and factory orders are rising. And the reason we have a better forecast for manufacturing this time around is that the manufacturing sector is sitting on unfilled orders. And as you see, unfilled capital goods orders have risen in the recent past. If you look at the global economy, it's very strong, and dollar is weakening. Combined, that helps our manufacturing and agricultural exports. A little concern is that there was, in the second quarter, an unexpected moderation of growth in Eurozone economies and in Japan. But the anticipation is that they're going to pick up and growth in the rest of the year. So all in all, we have this non-farm employment growth. We're going to have 1.3, just like before, for 2007, and again, 1.3% growth in 2008 before we charge ahead with 1.9% growth. And we look at about 1.4-1.5% population growth, so we anticipate that employment growth would closely mimic that population growth. In terms of personal income growth, please notice that we have relatively robust personal income growth forecast down the road. And if you look at May of odd year forecast for legislative purposes, if you look at 1999, that was after Asian financial crisis, and the economy was reeling the impact. We have still impact coming from Asian financial crisis and substantial slowdown in the economy. And when we put out the forecast, and we didn't see that economy would just expand so rapidly in 2000, and that resulted in tax rebate. In 2001, we had a declining economy, but we didn't anticipate that the economy would go down that bad. And 2003, we're still under much pressure. We were losing jobs in many numbers, and we didn't anticipate, though, the economy would stay down until the end of 2003, and in 2005, in May, when we put out the forecast, we thought that the economy would stay strong and rebound very strong, but we didn't anticipate continued strength in 2006. And here we are, strong growth in 2006 is one of the reasons why we have a fat tax rebate that Michael will be talking about. alternative scenarios. Again, let me remind you that we have relatively robust personal income growth for in our forecast. So we're compelled to point out some of the downside risks. So what are the downside risks? We may have deeper housing downturn and declining house prices.
Just a moment. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Dee. Going back to the graph just immediately previous, personal income growth, the projected income growth for the 2006 year ended up at a little over 6%. Is that all personal income growth, or is that factored also reduced by the income or by the growth of the population? That's just dollars over dollars, or is it dollars over dollars adjusted for population?
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Butler, this is total personal income growth.
So just dollars over dollars?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
And if you subtract 1.6% population growth, that's about 4.8% per capita income growth.
Still healthier than the national average, so if I may, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Butler, yes.
Thank you.
Going back to alternative scenario, we talked about a deeper housing downturn as downside risk, and the spillover credit crunch, not only to the U.S. financial market and the real sector of the economy, and also globally. And again, we cannot rule out the possibility of economic fallout coming from this credit crunch. Soaring oil prices and gasoline prices is one of a big downside risk. And again, stock market correction is another. If all this happens, consumer confidence will go down very bad, and consumer spending is affected very much negatively, and then there is a possibility of recession.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Monroe.
The most of the nation has seen actual decline in housing values. That has not yet hit Oregon. Do you anticipate that we will be following the nation and see some actual declines in housing values in our major metropolitan areas?
Chairs and Senator Monroe, in our forecast, we continue to anticipate house price appreciation, although much lower than in the past. We have to look at 5-year average and even beyond. If you look at 5-year growth, then Oregon's house price appreciation is not really bad compared to other states. And that's one reason for an optimism. Yes, we had sharp appreciation in the past 2 years, but we didn't have much appreciation before that. And in fact, if you go back in time, since the Asian financial crisis, the rate of house price appreciation was much lower than the national average. You heard complaints about Portland metro area's houses not being affordable at the end of last decade. But you didn't hear in the first part of this decade, and you don't hear much actually at this point, although the affordability deteriorated quite rapidly in the past 2 years. So in our forecast, we continue to anticipate that house price will appreciate, but at a very much lower rate than in the past. Now, having said that, one of the reasons why we have less problems in subprime mortgage is that we in Oregon have our share of problems, but at the same time, our house prices have been appreciating, and as a consequence, we have a little less problem with delinquencies and defaults. Does that?
Well, follow up, Mr. Chair. So what I hear you saying is that in some of the areas around the country, appreciation was much more sudden and much more rapid, and therefore the opportunity for fall was there to a greater extent than in Oregon. But you're still, when I looked at your possible negative scenario, I didn't see one of those possibilities as this state following the rest of the nation and seeing an actual decline in housing prices. You're saying because we've had steady appreciation, the subpar mortgages and so on, so far haven't affected us to the degree that they are in San Francisco and Los Angeles and Denver and other places around the world. It still strikes me that given what's happening in the rest of the nation, given the fact that Oregon is a part of the national economy, given the fact that we often follow what happens to the national economy, that ought to be a concern of ours that we ought to continue to monitor very, very closely.
Chair, Senator Monroe. You're absolutely right. We are closely monitoring the problem, and sure, it is one of the downside risks. I may not have emphasized that part with such power, but yes, that's one of the downsides we list.
Mr. Chair.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. And while we've interrupted the flow anyway, I did have a question back when you were talking about these housing the appreciation slowing. And you had said, I think, a 7 to 8% decrease in Oregon. Were you talking about Oregon when you said that? And then you said Medford and Bend were particularly down and Salem not so much?
Chairs, Representative Rosenbaum, it was 7 or 8% increase over the year.
And so that represented a reduction in the rate of growth rather than that we were actually seeing values falling that much.
Chairs, Representative Rosenbaum, that's absolutely correct.
And Mr. Chair, just one more question. Back to your previous slide to this one, your alternative scenarios. And you have a bullet point here that said the Fed increases rates to fight inflation, which seems counter to most of the punditry that I've been hearing lately, which is all about reducing interest rates and falling consumer confidence and money just needing to do something to put money more readily into the economy. But so what is that scenario where there would be dangers of inflation and problems going the other way?
Chairs, Representative Rosenbaum, when there is soaring oil prices and gasoline prices, and if you look at food prices these days, although inflation seems to be under control, because of raw materials prices, because the labor market is relatively tight at this point, and because the worldwide demand is strong, there is a chance, if all this happens, there is a chance that the inflation rate will flare up again, and that's when the Fed is in a position to increase interest rate to fight inflation. And we have to understand the fact that the Fed has dual objectives. One is to stabilize the financial market, but at the same time, it also controls the. It also tries to stabilize the economy. So one of the ways to stabilize the economy is to control inflation rate. To control inflation rate, the Fed has a big weapon of changing interest rate, and that's the possibility we're talking about.
Let me follow up on that just for a second. As I'm listening to that answer, I'm thinking about these scenarios. This credit crunch, as I understand it, is a combination of a couple of things, and there may be more than that. One of them is that some dollars simply disappear because the expected mortgage payments aren't coming. Other dollars aren't being moved from one kind of investment to another in the normal course of the market, and that both of those things end up being the crunch, as I understand them, and maybe others as well. But at the same time, as the number of dollars may be decreasing in the world, at the same time, because of other pressures we may be facing, inflation dangers at the same time? Is it simply the combination of force of different kinds of activities here? It sounds like a whipsaw, the way you're describing it.
Mr. Chair, this downside risk at this point seems a little remote, but if you look at what had happened in the 70s, no one can rule out a sharp increase in oil prices. No one can rule out the possibility of gas price reaching over $4. And couple that with tight labor market, relatively tight labor market in the U.S. economy. And if you look at China, the inflation rate is just rising rather rapidly. And they demand a lot of raw materials and a lot of intermediate goods, manufactured goods. So the worldwide demand is very, very strong. And even in the United States, although we have a slowdown in consumer spending, the anticipation is that consumer spending will resume. All in all, because of danger in materials cost, food cost, and because of tight labor market and because of strong demand globally, there is a chance that inflation rate will flare up. But this alone will not actually cripple the economy. On the other hand, if that is combined with a deeper housing downturn, and if the credit market problem spreads all over, then combined we see a possibility of recession. That's what we're alluding to. So does that satisfy your...
Maybe I could follow up again, if I might, just for a moment. It sounds like you're seeing indicators that both lead to potentially increased credit problems, and at the same time, other indicators that normally refer to the possibility of inflation. Is that a reasonable summary of what you're trying to say?
Mr. Chair, yes. And just bear in mind that even this week, the commercial banks are going to the Fed's window to borrow more money. And the credit problem is real. And short-term liquidity problem is real. So until the dust settles, we are not sure how this credit crunch will end up being. Will it be just a short-term financial volatility that we can observe, or will it spread over to the real sector of the economy? We're not sure, but the Fed is ready, and we heard that before, and we heard the Fed's readiness to jump in the credit market and overall financial market to stabilize the market. So and it seems that the market is confident that the Fed and the central banks of the world will be able to stabilize the future credit problems.
Thank you. That's reassuring.
Chair?
Senator Monroe.
There's one thing that you haven't talked about very much, and that's the weakening dollar. You mentioned it.
That's good.
But how does the weakening dollar fit into this scenario? And do you expect the dollar to continue to weaken? We all know that a weak dollar means that exports are more valuable, that we have we can sell our exports more easily in foreign countries. It also means that all foreign goods are more expensive in this country. Do you anticipate, first of all, that the dollar will continue to weaken against other major currencies, and how does that affect the scenario in terms of relative prosperity or possibilities of recession?
Chairs, Senator Monroe, that's an excellent question. We actually anticipate that dollar would continue to depreciate for another year, about 3 to 5% against major currencies. This weakening dollar helps and hurts our domestic economy. It helps because of our price competitiveness because of weak dollar. Our products become less expensive. We can sell more, so we can increase our exports, and that's a good thing. But at the same time, as you mentioned, that weaker dollar means higher import prices, and that's going to add to inflation pressure. So if the dollar declines in value steadily, and if the manufacturers can anticipate this steady decline in dollar, the firms can be ready, and they will take advantage of the situation. So it's in our interest, although Treasury Secretary says that strong dollar is in our interest, but in our perspective, a little weaker dollar is in our interest, and that's going to help our export sector. And by the way, our manufacturing and agricultural sector depend on exports a lot. So that weak dollar is a blessing rather than a vice for us.
Thank you.
To wrap up, economic forecast. We see some upside risks, but we can handle upside risk. And I close my economic presentation with a little pessimistic scenario. I'm an optimist, but I was trained to be a dismal scientist. We'll have to give you a pessimistic scenario anyway. 2007, with half of the years gone, we may see a further slowdown in employment front. Excuse me. So relative to baseline scenario, we may have much slower employment growth. And if this weakness continues through the end of 2008, we're not going to see any job growth in 2008 before rebounding in 2009. Mm. And again, with half of the year gone, pessimistic scenario calls for much slower income growth and really dismal personal income growth before rebounding in 2009. And Michael Kennedy will talk about revenue forecast.
Good morning. Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, members of the House and Senate Revenue Committees. For the record, my name is Michael Kennedy, senior economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. We've got about three sections today because a lot's happened since we last met. The first thing we'll do is we'll wrap up the prior biennium, and in particular, what everybody's interested in is what were the kicker results from the last biennium, and we'll go into that in a little bit of detail. Then sort of briefly characterize the close of session forecast, basically May plus legislative changes, and show basically where you left off when you cyanide in terms of an ending balance projection, et cetera, and then bring that forecast forward to include economic developments for the September forecast. So first off, it's actually a little bit of a surprise. We ended up on a down note, at least relative to the forecast. It's not a down note in terms of declining revenues, but a little bit short of the May forecast. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in terms of what do these things mean going forward. But personal income tax ended up about $45 million below the May forecast. Corporate income tax was up $9.9 million, and then all other revenues led primarily by insurance taxes, which I'll talk about a little bit later, were down. So $83.6 million below the May forecast. Projected expenditures, however, there's two things going on there. There were a few items, expenditures, that were appropriated during this regular session. But in addition, we've added in $25 million in reversions or unspent 0507 appropriations, and that's just to be in line with Legislative Fiscal Office's assumption about what that would be. Agencies have until December 31st to spend, and so by March we'll actually have a final assessment of what the ending balance implications were for that biennium. So moving forward, I guess one more thing. So if you look at the 44.8 and the 48.7, you're actually looking about roughly $93 million less in non-corporate revenues. And so that means $93 million lower in terms of the personal kicker surplus. And then $9.9 million more in the corporate surplus, both with implications that I'll talk about a long way. All right, so kicker surplus, the personal surplus, is now $1.071 billion. And this chart, I've worked with Legislative Revenue Office in detailing these numbers. The surplus number we now know as an actual. That number is hard-coded. What still remains yet to be finalized is the base number, the liability number that gets divided into to figure out the refund percentage. And because of a change in that liability number from post-credit to pre-credit liability, there's some issues there in estimating that number. But this is going to be very, very close to what the final number will be. And so you can see how sort of the kickers vary by income category. And what we've done here is added in as well what the distribution looks like, what percentage of the taxpayers fall into which category, so you can get an idea of how that's distributed. Interesting to note then the median filer is due, so that's the middle person. If you line them all up from lowest to highest, AGI would be at 297 would be the median kicker. The average is about $612. And sort of for each $1,000 of tax, it's $186 in kicker return. Down here you see a footnote. This is in the press packet, this table, for those who want to go back and use this information. 2006 Oregon tax forms, if you look at 40S, it's line 13, tax before credits. Form 40, it's line 29, and you just multiply 0.1862 times that number, and that's rough. That's basically the kicker check you're going to be due. If there are any questions, I know this was high on the media's interest list. Got a lot of press calls. Any questions regarding the kicker?
Senator Burke?
One of the issues around the kicker is that unlike the corporate kicker, it's actually sent out in checks. And we know that the direct cost of sending out those checks is right around $1 million that we have to pay to send out the checks. But what is the cost of borrowing the money to send that kicker refund out early?
Chair Burdick. That's an interesting question, and I was apprised beforehand of what was actually involved here, so I have a little bit of thoughts on that. In terms of the TANs borrowing, Right. That's what creates the biggest hole in November that we basically have to fill. The gross cost for the TANs borrowing is currently estimated at $57 million. But from that, you would want to subtract the arbitrage earnings that we earn. We basically borrowed that money in August and basically have it sitting there all the way through the point at which we actually need the money. We're allowed a six-month window to do that. So there's actually a considerable amount of arbitrage, in other words, money we're earning. And because we borrowed it at tax-exempt rates but basically earn money on it at regular rates out there, we actually bring those costs down considerably. I'm not sure what the net is going to end up being because it varies by whatever the interest rates are currently, but it's considerably lower than that. But certainly the case is that if we had that money and we plugged it into reserves instead of distributed as checks, we'd be in a position not to have to do chance borrowing, and there would be some savings there. There's no question about that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think it would be very useful to get a more precise number so that we can really assess accurately what the cost is of sending out these checks.
Chair Burdick, it's sort of, is it a cost of sending out the checks or is it a cost of tax poly? But I think we're looking at about $42 million net cost to the TANs, if I remember correctly. It's 42 to 45. Because the earnings show up in our interest earnings line and they're basically subsumed in there, we then have to show the gross cost down below to make sure we're not double counting. That's why the 57 shows up as a separate issue. But we are capable, it's actually the capital finance staff are capable of basically calculating the exact net cost of those dollars. And it's in that range.
Thank you.
Let me just follow up to make certain that I understand. I think what you just said is that because of the kicker checks going out when they do, we end up spending net interest in the amount of something like $42 to $45 million. Is that what you said?
Chair Barnard, that's correct.
That's
the total cost of cash flow management, but obviously $1.1 billion going out in checks is one of the biggest cash flow issues that is faced by the Treasury.
Right, and of course we can probably ask the Treasurer about that when we talk to him later. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just by way of clarification, I want to make sure that we understand that the cost of issuing those checks, calculating, issuing, sending, is borne in the check itself, and so that's reduced from the amount. Mm-hmm. But the $1.1 billion, $1.071 billion, has really been earned, collected, and deposited before the check is actually cut. And so what's happened is that we have not calculated any additional earnings that we have enjoyed, that the state has enjoyed, off of that $1.1 billion. And now we're going to say that there is a cost of cutting that check to borrow it back from the folks that we've over-collected from in the first place. So if we're going to calculate the cost of the TANs, and calculating and running that check out in November, then we probably ought to be fair. We probably ought to go ahead and say what's been the value of having received the $1.1 billion and to have been able to use it and enjoy it and sit on it and actually invest it, and we have been doing that for the past up to portions of it for the entire biennium. So thank you.
Representative Rocha. To paraphrase, there is more than one way to skin a policy cat.
Representative Rosenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like there is another column that would be useful to have here, which is something that would show the distribution by income level of where that $1 billion plus is actually going. Because you can look at this and you see, you know, the percentage of the population in each income category, and you can see their average refund, but you can't really tell, so where is the bulk of this money that we're refunding going, which categories this is directed at? Do you have some rough figures like that in your head?
Mr. Chair.
Or am I jumping ahead to the next slide?
Chris and I actually talked about this yesterday. You could do the numbers if you went back and, you know, basically did the weighting, but the top 10%, they're the 100-plus and over, account for roughly 50% of the total figure. So 10%, 50%. And that's just a perfect representation of what the tax liability for 06 looks like. They mirror each other.
So the people making over 100,000 are going to get 50% plus of the benefit of this kicker refund, then?
House, Chair Representative Rosenbaum, they're going to get 50% of that $1.1 billion in their mailboxes. But that's because they paid 50% of the total $5.7 billion in tax for the year projected. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to what degree? And obviously then at the bottom you have 37, you have over a third of the people, and that's going to represent probably less than 10% of the total kicker.
Just a quick comment, if I could, on that issue. If you look at the median number that he gave us, slightly less than $300, and the average number, slightly more than $600, that doesn't tell you exactly what the distribution is, but it makes it very clear that high income is going to get more than low income does, because those two numbers wouldn't be that much different if it followed a normal curve. Did Representative Witt have a question?
No, thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You. Please, go ahead.
So, at the risk of actually telling the joke after the punchline, something like that. Moving on to the closed session forecast, and there's not really much of note here. You knew what the May forecast was, and it's interesting to note that the net impact of tax laws, at least those bills that were signed into law after the May forecast, is $19.1 million. So you've got a lot of activity going on there, but you know, it basically offsets itself to some degree. Add back into this the $24.8 million small business tax credit that was already into law and factored into the May forecast, and you're looking at basically on net almost no change, but a lot of offsetting actions. And as I understand, there's going to be more involved discussion about the underlying tax bills behind this, so I'll just move on from here. You have the projected beginning balance up, and that's primarily due to that reversion assumption of $25 million. No change to the other issues, and so all on net, you now have an available resource number of 14.139. And subtract from that the projected expenditures, and you have a $184 million ending balance as of the close of session, which, just to put that in context, looking historically, is fairly high. It's been a long time, I think, since that kind of cushion has been left on the table. So looking forward, just how have things been tracking, and honestly they've been tracking exceedingly well, which is very nice. It's probably customary for this point of a business cycle where things are basically growing fairly stable and are fairly predictable. The one thing you note here is that withholding and estimated payments, which were all related to 2007 activity, are slightly higher than forecast. So you'll see that the personal income tax forecast is up slightly when we get to the numbers, and this is the reason why 2007 is looking a tad bit stronger. The risk still is there that it doesn't really represent what's going on, and we have a correction in April, but the risk of that's still fairly low. But I raise it because it's there. Where the negative is in final payments, basically after we release the forecast. It's a fairly small number, but all this is related to 06 activity. So you change your liability estimate for 06, but if 07 is tracking, it has no future implications. You don't adjust the future forecast because you appear to be tracking fairly well. So basically, things are on target, which is nice. Corporate's even closer. It's only $3 million off. There's more play in here because corporations have multiple tax years going at one time. But really, the bottom line is we're tracking quite well. So what does that mean? And this is the September forecast versus what we just looked at, the close of session forecast. The biggest change here is personal income tax is $55.5 million. However, there's a caveat there. It was in June the issue was raised of how much money out of the kicker are we going to keep because people have past due tax liabilities, child support, others of these things. And in looking at past kicker distributions, you can see the impact. You can see payments kind of jump in November as the kickers are distributed because Department of Revenue says, oh, that's all well and nice, but you owe us $250. We're going to keep your kicker. So what we've done is we've sort of done some analysis and figured that the range of that potential for $1.1 billion is between $20 and $50 million. So we've picked the midpoint, $35 million, as our guess of what that value is going to be. That wasn't in the May forecast. It just was not on the radar screen that was something that was really a substantive thing. But we've included it here. So otherwise, personal income tax would be up $20 million, which is you can sneeze and change it by more than that. So we would call the personal income tax forecast basically flat. A little bit stronger for 07, but then a little bit weaker in 08 because of kind of the risk factors that we've been looking at, the credit issues, et cetera. Corporate income tax, no real change. And the other revenues here, this is predominantly the issue here is insurance tax. Right at the end of last biennium, Department of Consumer and Business Services analysts noticed that the retaliatory component of that tax was falling off sharply. And they basically trendlined what they had for previous years and had some growth in there, and it really flattened off and leveled off. And they redid their model to try to capture that, and basically it ended up being a pure level shift in the expectation in those insurance taxes. That's aside from the fact of the law change for the apportionment of insurance companies. So what you see here just in the outer years is basically just a $40 million drop in expected insurance taxes over time. And aside from that, some slightly lower interest earnings because now we don't have that $93 million sitting in the bank. We gain it back because the kicker's gotten smaller, but there's some slightly less interest earnings. Basically, a few negatives across the board. All on net, the total structural revenue change is $400,000. And if that isn't close to zero, I don't know what it is for general fund revenues. It's fairly stable. The issues here are then you have less kicker distributions, which are a net plus for us, but you have a smaller beginning balance, and you distribute 9.9. So those cancel each other out. Those issues across the biennium, and basically we're always going to net out. We were hedged against those. So when you come to the bottom line, you actually have a $400,000 change in the fiscal situation in between the close of session and May forecasts, which is pretty much no change. Now, the risks of the forecast, what we've generally looked at, we've talked about the risk generally economically speaking, and particularly as those risks, say, nationally and in Oregon, relate to corporate profits and general personal income, but then also the asset markets, because we're about 11% of personal income taxes related to capital gains. And so you look at asset markets and what they're doing, there is some risk there of variance between what we currently have in the model and what happens. More specifically, we've talked about before how we try to get a good read on where we stand today, even though we won't get tax returns to really know what's going on for some time to come. So we try to make estimates of where tax liability stands today, and if those are fairly accurate, then your only error relates to your expectation going forward in terms of growth. So to the degree that what we're seeing today sort of in collections and any other data we can have are wrong, you then have a base level shift whether it's up or down. So that's really where a lot of, at this point, the risks lie, in that the readings you get from collections are misreadings in terms of what's actually going on, whether it be stronger or weaker. But in May, we talked about this, how we personally feel that the risk distribution right now is weighted more to the downside. We believe that this is a baseline forecast, but that the probability of being, say, $1 billion above this forecast is a lot lower than the probability we might be $1 billion down, solely because of where we've come. We've seen such rampant growth up where we stand now that you wouldn't expect that the probability profile is evenly distributed. We're not going to see... I wouldn't imagine we'll see another 24% general fund growth biennium this time, given that that's what we just experienced. But all the negative risk factors come to play, you could easily see $1 to $1.5 billion on the downside. So continue to just point that out, and we'll keep you posted, obviously. So no change currently in the expectations or in the economic model. You get pretty much no change throughout the extended horizon of the forecast for general fund revenues. This chart, I just think it's interesting always to keep in mind what the volatility is in this system. And this chart gives you not only the blue bars, which are the structural volatility, which you can see is quite wide, but then when you toss in the kickers, the kicker actually adds distortion to sort of the net revenue picture. So it's just always good to keep in mind, what our potential for variance from this forecast is. And that's it for general fund. If there's no questions there, lottery's even less painful. This is the current forecast. In May, we knew what basically the eighth quarter distribution was from lottery, so we knew what lottery looked like for last biennium, so I won't rehash that. It's basically no change. The beginning balance change
changed a little, down $2.2 million to $64. You can see earnings are slightly down, and that's in traditional games. It's pretty much instant tickets and in Keno, but it's pretty much no change, and video lottery is pretty much flat. It's tracking almost perfectly with the sales. So for after 2 years of chasing it on the upside, at least currently, we appear to be tracking quite well with the forecast. The only real change here is an additional $21 million in administrative savings. And that is basically lottery getting to the end of last business year and saying, you know, here's how much it costs us to administer, here's how much we basically allocated, here's the difference. And the total of it was 56. They knew for sure of 35 of it in May when they finally did their accounting. There was an additional $21 million. So that's the majority of the change. And then when you actually have an allocation number to plug in and you can actually calculate some interest earnings, because in close of session, $13 million was left on the table as opposed to zero, as has been the case in prior years, you actually get a bump up in expected interest earnings on the Economic Development Fund. So when all is said and done, the ending balance now for the Economic Development Fund is projected about $27.6 million.
Chair Verde.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are the administrative savings in part due to the increased or the decreased percentage of commissions that the video poker locations get?
Chair Burdick, not in the explicit sense that they are going to lower the commission rate structure here in the near future, because that is factored in and has been factored into the forecast for some time. What it really amounts to is, however, when the growth is greater than expected, a lot of those dollars slop into those lower and lower commission brackets so that the commission rate actually drops down. And our actually state rate transfer rate that we assume in the model is a product of here's what your administrative cut's going to be in, here's what your commission cut's going to be in, here's what we're going to get to keep. And when that commission rate sort of falls, that blended rate starts falling, that's when there's unanticipated dollars that basically are residual and transferred after each business year, if that answers your question.
Thanks, sir.
And as I say, no real change to basically underlying sales forecast. Things are tracking quite well, so what you see in the outer years is literally no change in, you know, sort of the resource picture, just the one-time bump in administrative savings. On the administrative savings level, though, before we get into the 09-11 budget process, we're going to revisit with lottery our assumptions around what that blended rate looks like going forward and sort of the administrative cut. Because at this point, if you continue sort of to under-predict that value, you end up seeing these dollars come in after the session. And I suspect some people might have liked to have $21 million sitting there on the table. I'm not sure, I'm guessing, but I would like to have it on my table if I had the chance. So we're going to revisit that before the next budget cycle to try to get a handle on, you know, if you can really predict those things coming in, you've got to put them in the forecast and not have them just showing up, you know, after the fact. And then finally, how do these earnings flow into the system? And basically, you can see what the projection is out here. Debt service needs to go up. There's more bonding. But in particular, the Ed Stability Fund, which that's a good thing. You know, to take a step back now, we have $184 or $85 million ending balance, in general fund, $27 million ending balance in lottery. Projected, I think, almost 340 by the end of this biennium in the rainy day fund, and then over 400 million in the educational stability fund. So when someday a recession does occur and revenues start falling in below what we predict, it will at least be easier to provide that news when the answer to that solution is, oh, we may have to take a withdrawal from a rainy day fund, rather than we may have to cut $500 million out of the school budget. So from a personal, as a messenger standpoint, as well as I'm sure from a policy standpoint, it is a lot better place to be.
I'm sorry, would you repeat the number that you had for the rainy day fund? I missed it.
Mr. Chair, the deposit is going to be $319 million, and I can't quite remember what the interest piece, Paul may remember what the assumption was.
About $20
million. Yeah, I think we're talking $340 million by the end of this biennium.
And Mr. Chair, you have the 1% at the end of the biennium ending balance would be right around $140 million. Mm-hmm. So you have that would occur sometime in the early part of 2010.
after the buying.
To add to the rainy day fund.
Right.
Thank you. Now, contrast that. Given the statement you just made, I need to challenge that a little bit. Contrast that, if you would, please, with what happened to us during the 2001-03 biennium and the 2003-04 biennium in terms of budget cuts and borrowing.
Mr. Chair, it is interesting. You do look at the 2001-03 biennium and the structural drop there between the May forecast or the closed session forecast and when all was said and done was $2.4 billion. However, okay, so now contrast that with where we are today and you look at what the risks are out there. But at that point, Oregon was so much more heavily exposed to that particular phenomenon, the high-tech industry, the manufacturing, the stock market in particular. And it's one of the things we've continued to discuss amongst ourselves, you know, with the advisory groups, to what degree is Oregon exposed to these other risks like these financial markets? You know, and I would say we're at least only on average exposed, if not even less so. At this point, I would think I would not want to be a policy or budget person for New York City because I expect that at some point they're going to have to realize, you know, sort of the comeuppance from basically the last 3 years of just insane profit growth. So I would say our risks, while they're there, looking nothing like what we now know our risks stood to be in 2001. You know, that was the single biggest drop in at least the history of close of session forecasts, so it's what we consider an outlier.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, this may be a question more for Paul. On page 12 in his general fund revenue forecast. In the close of session forecast, the projected expenditures, does that include the rainy day 1%, the 140, or is that taken out of the 184.2? Do you understand the question? When they do the close of session, they account for that.
I understand. Representative Berger, the 184, the way that calculation will be done is it's 1% of what appropriations were for 2007-09. So you'd look at that 1%, and that's about $140 million. So you'd compare that with what the ending balance is. So if this is projected to be, if let's say the projection is correct, it's 184, you'd say, okay, it's above 1%, so 140 goes into the rainy day fund. The other 44.6 would be available for allocation.
That's what I'm making sure, that we've actually spent part of that 184 essentially already, or at least
allocated it.
It.
Yes, correct. Right, that's correct.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, and the way we are currently treating these, you can see the current distribution. Well, when you go forward, actually, we're treating these because the distribution to the fund will be made in, like, this biennium for last biennium. So you wouldn't see the 140 showing up until we start to show revenue forecast for 2009-11. And then you'll see it as a negative because that would be the current projection would be that we would have this 140, and you'll see it coming off of 2009-11 revenues before net available resources.
Follow up.
Please.
Mr. Chair, Michael, I'm glad you mentioned this because I think we, going forward as a committee and as a state, need to have this brought up every time somewhere here, that there is this other piece that, it's a complicated sort of accounting procedure, but I don't want to lose track of it that, oh, that's any balance. Well, that's any balance, but we have plans for it somewhere, and it's going to impact the next biennium. So I guess I'm just trying to make sure we don't lose track of that.
Right, and I think that's a very important point that Representative Berger makes. I just simply want to note, and the reason I asked the question about the 2003 and the 2003-04 budgets and those, the effect on the changes in our income is that that if these numbers pan out the way we're looking at it now, it looks to me as though we're going to have something in the neighborhood of $1 billion in reserves at the end of this biennium, assuming your predictions for this biennium are correct. And yet, our loss just in the 2001-03 biennium was 2.5 times that much, and that doesn't count the lack of capacity that we had in the 2003-04 biennium to restore programs. I mean, those of us who were here during that time dealt with some very painful things. And, of course, people out in the communities who benefited from the basic programs of state supports are very well aware of the fact that we were unable to fund them. So while a reserve of $1 billion looks like a lot of money, in reality, it isn't. It is a very modest reserve against the possible exigencies of the way our income works. And I appreciate the report. Other questions or comments? Yes, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kennedy, I don't know what your slide number, but our page number is page 8, which shows the personal income growth, and page 14, which shows the general fund revenue growth. And the incongruence between those two numbers, the 0103 time period looks like it averaged, actually, Oregon's personal income growth was positive, about 3%, but yet our revenue growth dropped 7.5%. Could you explain in a little more detail the incongruence of those two numbers?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator Morris, what personal income doesn't include are the sources of income and tax liability that are most volatile in our system, and the two of those are going to be capital gains on the personal income tax side in particular. Schedule E growth, this is where proprietorships are in there, but there are some other like pass-through incomes that don't show up there, and these are fairly volatile sources. They also tend to be taxed at the high marginal rate because they're high-income individuals, and so you have a lot of tax coming from those sources, and they don't appear in here, but they are the ones that literally capital gains dropped by 54% over the course of 2 years, so that's where a lot of that drop came from. Schedule E, similar, and then corporate income tax. Again, when you look at general fund revenue growth overall, a lot of that volatility is being driven by the incredible volatility in corporate income tax. So those are the two sources of income that really have way more volatility than what you're looking here, which is driven 60-70% by wage and salary growth. You've got some interest earnings in there, et cetera. It's Social Security. So that's the reason for the discrepancy and why our system is more volatile than personal income growth on average.
Follow-up questions, Mr. Chair. with respect to personal income growth, do those numbers reflect the pass-through corporate entities as well? Are they included in that personal income growth?
Yeah, I'll defer to Dave. He knows the personal income.
Chairs, Senator Monroe, Morris, excuse me. Yes, the proprietor's income and dividend, interest, and rent are all included in personal income. But the way the tax base is calculated is a little different. Like Michael mentioned, that the capital income, capital gains is not included in personal income. That's one of the very volatile components. And there are some components of income that is not included in official personal income statistics. So that's why there seems to be a little discrepancy between personal income growth and tax base increase.
Following up on that, I wonder if you could produce for us a chart that would include those items with personal income so we could compare that against the general fund growth. That would be an interesting, maybe that's something for Paul. That would be a very interesting exercise. I noticed the same thing that Senator Morris noticed, and I appreciate the explanation.
Mr. Chair, we can put that together. It's the BEA or Department of Commerce definition of income versus AGI, and effect becomes a tax base. So we've looked at that, and we can put that together. The other thing I might add to Senator Morris's question is one of the things that we noticed, and I know Michael noticed this, is that during that down period you have a number of the components that reduce liability, such as the personal exemption credit, are indexed. So those are growing. The standard deduction is growing. At the same time, income is very flat. And keep in mind, these numbers up here are not adjusted for inflation. That's straight personal income. So the real inflation-adjusted personal income for 2002, for example, was negative.
Okay.
And so people are getting a bigger exemption credit and that kind of thing, and that's lowering the base for you.
Thank you. Other questions, comments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that Mr. Beck's presentation suggests that we maybe are not aware of how close we may be to another period of stagflation, and I'm concerned with China owning so much of our debt and being able to float their currency markets that there could be significant political repercussions as well as economic repercussions.
Borrowing a lot of money has a repercussions that you may not be aware of at the time you do it. And the federal government has certainly done that. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I found very interesting the discussion of the capital gains portion of income as it relates to personal income tax and our change. One thing that should be noted was that one of the most volatile portions of our income that occurred during the 2001-2003 decline was the capital sector. And did we learn anything from that in our tax policy in Oregon? I think I calculated the other day that in 2013 we will be in our projections, we will actually be counting on as much capital gain income to in Oregon's general fund as we were during the entire biennium of 1999-01. In other words, that's the increase in the capital sector's market. And we have continued to balance our budget based upon the vagaries of the capital market. Mm-hmm. And I know that in the process, I think it's 2350, there's a there's a big look in the process of Oregon's revenue sources and what it is that we're looking at doing at some point in the future. My concern is that if we continue to determine that we want to balance our budget on the capital markets, and particularly where the home values in Oregon are not estimated to come down, but the only decline that we see is the rate of increase, not the actual values, but the actual rate of increase declines, then what happens is that we are moving a greater portion of that capital sector that we rely upon away from the dot-coms and over to our real estate markets. And I realize that some of those real estate markets, a large portion of them, are housing, which are probably exempt under any kind of capital gain. But to the extent that we outstrip in Oregon, which has been amply discussed here, we're actually outstripping the national incomes increases in values of our homes, which will eventually move us into a taxable personal residence situation in Oregon. And my concern is that we will then begin to rely upon that additional piece of the vagary of the capital markets, and we need to be very, very cautious. You got trains coming in both directions, and the question is not when will they meet, it's where will they meet in that process, and will we be ready? And Mr. Chair, you talked about the $1 billion-plus dollars that we'll have in resources and revenues reserves set aside for rainy days and those kinds of things. Those will not accomplish what it is that you want to do if you want to continue to spend at the same level and increase spending at the same levels that we have enjoyed in the last two biennia.
Thank you, Representative. Other comments? We have the State Treasurer Randall Edwards to be with us at 10:30. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your presentation today. We appreciate the fact that your May forecast was so accurate that you have very little to adjust it on today, and that's appreciated. And with that, the House Committee on Revenue will stand in recess until 10:30, when we expect to hear from the State Treasurer.
And the Senate. Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue will reconvene, and all the cats must be herded now back up to the podium. Okay, now our next agenda item here is an update from our State Treasurer, the Honorable Mr. Edwards, on the state's bond rating and financial condition. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Chair and members of the Joint Committee here. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and it's a pleasure to be here today. I got to say, I was before you not too long ago talking about buying an airplane ticket to New York once the session ended, post the creation of a rainy day fund, because I believed Oregon then, as it does today, have a great financial story to tell, to really tell Wall Street that Oregon deserves a better bond rating. And I'm here to say that we got that upgrade just within the last couple of weeks. 2 weeks ago, we were informed by Moody's that they were going to bump our bond rating up to AA2. Last week, we both got Standard & Poor's upgraded us to a AA. And Fitch is still wanting to give a little more time but bump this up to a positive outlook, which is the precursor to getting an upgrade. So all of that's really good news for the state. And why I say that is that many of us in this room weathered the six special sessions, the unbelievably difficult time that we had in this state when the recession hit us. And again, I think this is more of a story not about the fact that we got an upgrade in our bond rating, which, again, will save the state tens of millions of dollars, if not hundreds, over a long time, but more about the leadership in this building and the people of Oregon. It has been a story where we went into that recession in 2001 with very little protection against a downturn, and, of course, that was a historic downturn for the state of Oregon, not only in terms of what happened in the markets, but also the recession and how deep and how hard it hit this state. So really, I just, my hat's off to you as much as it is to the work that my office has done and the governor in leading on many fronts. And as a result of this really 6 years of hard work, the capstone was getting this bond rating back to where it was prior to the recession. And I would submit that today we are in a stronger financial position going forward than we were when we went into that recession. Certainly, the two rainy day funds that we have now, both the Education Stability Fund, Rainy Day Fund, and the one that you just created this last session, those two combined, when we were before the Wall Street analysts saying, those combined now, and given what we project, by the end of this biennium, we should have close to $1 billion. We had nothing even close to that. And I think I've mentioned saying when we were talking about creating a second rainy day fund, I was before both of these committees talking about pinching myself because we'd never even had any savings account. Now we have two. We're in a situation where, in many ways, we should be saying this is a very long-term opportunity to continue to help stabilize the revenue picture for the state of Oregon. That was one thing. The pension reforms and the financial structure now of the pension system, we went from a $17 billion liability, if you recall. Now we're at 104% funded, and that was based on 05 returns, so we're even better funded than that. Again, that wasn't an easy issue to take on. The legislature and the governor took that on. And it was, again, a story of Oregon's leadership in trying to right financially a challenge for the state of Oregon. Many states continue to wrestle with their liabilities and their pension system. So, again, my hat's off to you in the sense that we now have a very good story on that front as well. They've also looked at the economy today. We are certainly, and you just heard, we're doing fine, at least revenue from a revenue picture, we're still very stable. We've bounced back more rapidly than other states, and that's been a big plus for the state of Oregon. They see a diversifying economic base. A couple years ago, I had some of these analysts come out and see parts of Oregon to really experience firsthand some of the changes that are occurring in this state, and I know each of you in your own districts see this, and there are still many challenges on that front, but the fact is Oregon really has improved its economic diversity, which, again, is a strength to the state of Oregon, and which they also give us credit. From a debt management burden, Oregon gets a lot of credit for having both a very prudent oversight of its debt, which, again, you play a critical role in that. My office being the central issuer of all the state bonds, again, is something that not a lot of states have one single person overseeing that. That was very, again, a positive for us. And our debt position, while it has increased with the bonding that you've asked us to do, the pension obligation bonds that we sold, our debt profile is still very modest and again, in a very healthy state. And lastly, just the controls that we have in Oregon. They see that Oregon has had a long history of managing itself, and going back to that story, they saw that some very tough decisions had to be made by you when the chips were down. And by your leadership, we were able to show that in the end, we had to make some decisions, and those are now paying off in the state's bond rating. So really, this is more of a story than it is just the fact that we got an upgrade. And it's one where I think we can all take credit, and Oregonians should be very proud of what's happened in this building for the last 5 to 6 years. You've made a huge difference. Having said that, they too, again, cite a few things that I think you just discussed a little bit about some of the challenges of the state of Oregon. They're still concerned about the volatility of our tax system. We tend to have one source of income for the state, and they've been nervous about that. They talk about the kicker, both the corporate and the personal. And they're going to see us write the big check out to the public for $1 billion plus. I don't know exactly what the number you just learned, but it's a very large number, and that to them also is a concern. Again, if you look at it from their perspective, even though there's obviously a lot of political interest in that check, the point is when you're sitting in Wall Street saying, well, you've got $1 billion, you're now sending back out to the public, whereby in the past, if you could, and you demonstrated a portion of that could be used for a rainy day fund, they see that in the economic good times we have had a challenge in having money set aside. So my point is that's been an issue for them. And the last one, and I keep arguing with them over this point, we've had it for over 100 years, and that's the initiative system. They do not like variables. They don't like things that you can, as we all know, can have set before us whereby they have an enormous price tag to the state of Oregon, and not just Oregon, other states on the West particularly. This has been a way to legislate that some on the East Coast still don't understand why we have that power, but what we do, and I keep reminding them we have, and we've had it for a long time, and there are checks and balances, but having said that, they've also seen the state struggle with implementation of Measure 5, the cost of Measure 11, and the story goes on. So, in fact, one of them was nervous about what the implications of changes to our land use planning would be, because one of the things we've touted for Oregon, of course, is that one of the reasons why people locate and live here is because of quality of life, and they were concerned about what would changes in our land use do to that long-term livability in the state. So having said that, those are sort of the challenges we continue to face, at least by Wall Street's viewpoint, and I would submit things that we should continue to work on. But bottom line here is you and the governor and my office and my staff really can, and pop the champagne if you want, that we have really done a great job in bringing Oregon back, and I would say in an even stronger position, because, again, two rainy day funds, if you will, really will help cushion the pension reforms in the end that should long-term, at least financially, be in a situation where we're much better off and not see the volatility we've had in the past. And just generally, the leadership of stepping up when we needed to. Other states, one to the south of us, did a lot of other financial maneuvering that continues to keep their bond rating low, and they struggle with trying to bring their bond rating up because they have borrowed upon borrowings, and of course, that's not a good thing. So having said that, I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. This is a great day for Oregon. This is something many of you in this room have worked very hard on, and I appreciate it very much. Be happy to answer any questions.
Well, and I wanted to thank you, and I know on behalf of many, for your contribution to this effort. And I particularly appreciate the fact that over the years, when this legislature is considering one policy or another, you've always been there to let us know what the impact's going to be on bond ratings and what the significance is in terms of our overall budget. I wanted to start off by asking you, we do have $1 billion in personal kicker going out. If you could wave a magic wand and suddenly convert that to a rainy day fund instead of a tax refund, a real rainy day fund that would even take into account close to the worst case scenario, what impact would you see that having on the bond rating? Would we just stay where we are, or would you see would you anticipate an improvement? Further improvement.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I appreciate your compliment, and really it's been also my staff. I want to thank them. They've been before this committee, or many committees, not me, but them, and have talked to you about some of the concerns or needs that we have, and I appreciate that. It's hard to read the crystal ball from them, but I would say that even though, and I pointed out, the corporate kicker was, again, bipartisanly supported to make part of a rainy day fund, and that, therefore, it kind of showed that the kicker, as you both personal and corporate, at least in this case, the corporate, was not completely out of the reach of being able to do something with it that would have a long-term financial benefit to the state. But then they still go back to cite that the kicker is still of a concern to them. My sense is if you could put the personal kicker, and there are lots of thoughts about how do you do that into some additional savings, because, again, we will at some point hit another downturn, and, again, that will be part of the cushion, and, yes, we will draw that down. We then have to fill it back, or you will have to fill it back up, and we will have zero in that account, I would assume, and actually, I think you can't draw it completely down, but the point is you put a floor on it, if you will. But the point is you're going to have that and the Education Stability Fund depleted substantially, I'd assume, and you need to refill it. So, again, I don't want to necessarily get in a policy debate about what that would look like, but I think if you were to be able to capture some of that personal income tax kicker and put it a long term into a rainy day fund, that would be helpful.
Questions? Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sort of a follow-up on that. We were talking earlier with the economists about the arbitrage on the funds that are available in the Treasury in terms of our own borrowing. I mean, I know that you have to borrow money from time to time in order to tide the state over until the next set of tax receipts come in. And then at other times, you have money in the Treasury that you can lend out to earn some interest. It occurs to me that in the event that we had a larger rainy day fund, we would more likely be in a position where we would be borrowing fewer dollars on the external market and maybe even be able to earn some interest for the Treasury. And Oregon taxpayers might actually benefit from that. Could you comment on that question a little bit?
I think, as you know, Mr. Chair, that we're about ready to go out, and we already have it. I'm looking at Laura.
It's already done.
We did it. Okay. We borrowed, was it a little over 800? 800 plus million in tax anticipation notes. Again, this is a short-term borrowing to manage cash, and the reason, primary reason of that is that we're writing a billion-dollar check, which comes out of the bank, and we need to cash flow the state. So that's part of what's happening there. Yeah, if we had a larger rainy day fund, and by the way, the other thing that you did, which I think was important, was to set reserves aside, try to shoot for some target of an ending balance. We've over the years driven that down to zero, and then hence drove ourselves to a point where we had to borrow. So making sure we had money at the end of the biennium is also equally important. And if that were part of the mechanism of a rainy day fund, or some, as is the rainy day fund, if you recall, up to 1% of the ending balance gets dropped into that. Managing that, I think, would be important and helpful. That arbitrage you're talking about, if we again had a larger rainy day fund, yes, we could actually, I think, internally use those monies versus having to go out on the marketplace, or it'd help anyway. So it's something that I we could talk about that in the next session, is what would that look like if you wanted to pursue that?
Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on Senator Burdick's question, personally, would you support the legislature modifying the personal kicker to divert it into the reserve fund or eliminate it completely?
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, let me put it this way. I think you have to make a decision what's the best and what's politically possible. I mean, I think that's always the reality check here, is what can you get past, probably with the voters. But I think you can make a very strong case that the kicker, personal and corporate, and we tend to easily try to make a distinguishing point here, but the kicker, the mechanism of it and the calculation of it, even though it's two separate things, the mechanics of it basically are the same. I think you can make a very strong case that we need to continue to look at building our reserves long term, and that the personal kicker could be part of that. And therefore, as we just showed, by taking a portion of the corporate kicker, or taking the corporate kicker, most of it, and using it in a rainy day fund, it actually did have a financial benefit to the state. That was the final piece that pushed the ratings back up. When we go forward, I think you got to say, at some point, we're going to deplete those rainy day funds. How do you get them back up? One's filled with lottery. The other one will be, done for the most part, or have some in it, and it will grow slowly. I think you got to look at how do you fill that back up, and that might be the time you make the argument that we need to look at both kickers as potential funding for that.
Questions?
No, Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, following up on that, during the last session, my colleague here, Senator Morse, had a proposal that he kind of threw out that I think would have capped the kicker checks at $800. I think it was $800. In other words, right. anything above that would have been captured and could go into a rainy day fund or something. And I think that ended up reducing the total cost by something like two-thirds. Mm-hmm. Because most of the money goes to relatively wealthy individuals. That strikes me as the kind of reform that might meet with support from the voters. We all know the voters like their kickers, mm-hmm. like their kicker checks,
right.
and that any attempt to tamper with it is a political danger to all of us. But it struck me that that Senator Morse's approach to, which would, in fact, 90% of people would get their full kicker, only the very wealthy would have some of it skimmed off to go into a rainy day fund. That kind of an approach seemed to me to be something that might be politically acceptable.
Is that a question or
a
statement?
That's a question. Do you agree with me?
Dang, I thought it was a statement.
I'll let you off the hook,
like
Randall. You don't need to weigh in on this.
Well, again, I think that's. Are there ways to capitalize? I mean, capture the personal income tax kicker is the political question, and I think what Senator Morris did was to say maybe there's a way to get halfway between. And again, the thing that's shocking actually is the size of this personal kicker. I mean, it's the biggest one we've ever written, and then when you go back in time and see how many times we've put the kicker out, it's a large amount of money. So I think the debate over, and I know there's an interim discussion on tax reform, I think this has got to be a critical piece of it.
Is there a chance, has the impact been already fully realized of having this $1 billion kicker? Is there a chance that once the $1 billion kicker goes out, Wall Street is going to say, oh my gosh, and lower us again?
It's hard to predict that. I don't think they would immediately do something like that. Again, we're going to go into the next recession so better prepared than we did the last one, obviously. That should be, depending on how deep the next recession is, and Paul's got his Ouija board out, and he's going to tell us when that's going to happen. But the point is what they will start doing is monitoring how are you going to manage post the usage of that rainy day fund, and if you pretty much deplete both of them to some degree or a large degree, how you fill them back up. The lottery education stability fund, I mean, that was one of the strengths of that, of course, is it continually feeds with a certain percentage of lottery, and then it caps out at 5%. And I remember a few years back when we were talking about that design, we didn't think we'd hit the cap for years. Paul's nodding yes. I mean, we weren't going to hit the cap. We probably hit a recession before we got to the cap. Well, that's actually changed. Line games have filled that pot a lot faster. We're more likely to hit 5% much more quickly. But the answer directly is I don't know how I don't think they'd immediately take an action. They might put us on an outlook, negative outlook, and see how we manage in filling our rainy day fund. That's also saying we don't do anything with the volatility of our tax system, which is, again, the one of the pieces that they continue to raise of, you're unique in the country, or one of the unique states in the country, which you have one source of income, and it's an income tax, and it's very volatile.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart.
Thank you. Just a last follow-up on the change in the credit rating.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that this is worth some money to us. Do you have any idea what that means in terms of dollars? Interest rates.
I can only give you just
interest rates should
ballpark.
Be a little lower.
Yeah, yeah. We'll see. And it's these are always there's small fractions differences, if you will, in interest rate costs. But then when you're selling hundreds of millions of dollars and, you know, billions over time, that makes a difference. My assumption is we will stay at this level, assuming we can weather the next recession much better, we should, than we have in the past. We should be saving a lot of money. I think it once was predicted well over, it was like $300 million or something like that over a 20-year period of time, which is a substantial amount of money.
I have a follow-up, if I may. Please. It's actually a different topic. There have been quite a bit of financial turmoil in the markets lately. Could you comment on the you're a big banker in a way. I mean, you have a lot of assets out there, and you're also borrowing money in different accounts.
Right.
What effect is this financial turmoil that the United States is facing, maybe even worldwide is facing, have on your operations, if any?
Right. Mr. Chair, at this point, you know, the volatility has not really impacted as much. And I think what's important and the big difference between maybe on some short-term interest rates, that's where you would see it. But largely, you know, as an investor, with the pension fund and other trusts that we have, those are such long-term investments that you really, through the balanced portfolios we have, we tend to weather these ups and downs, and even though there are spikes within weeks, it doesn't, over time, really dramatically impact this. The point, though, was during this last, when we had the three consecutive down markets, that hadn't happened since the Great Depression. So that did have an impact on where we stood. If I recall, the pension fund went down about $31 billion, and now we're at $65 billion. So, I mean, the diversification and the long-term strategy continues to help Oregon along. So, one other point I wanted to make about the bond rating, and this may go to, we also have this School Bond Guarantee Act, which allows the state or my office to allow school districts to use our credit rating to go out to the marketplace, and it's really helpful for smaller school districts that don't tend to go out very often. That got also upgraded, so that should also save school districts money, which, again, is a very good thing.
Representative Broom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Treasurer, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
I too, along with all of us, salute you for your office, the good work that's happened over the last 6 years. On the issue of tax volatility, and it's an issue that quite a few of us are passionate about and put our name behind, and of course took the arrows that go with that this last session, but that's okay. You mentioned California, which I mean, all our neighbors, you know, Washington, Idaho, Nevada, California, all have a sales tax system. Of course, California is an anomaly. It's, as you say, borrowing on borrowing on borrowing. How do we compare? How does our bond rating compare with our other neighbors, Washington and Idaho, and me? I don't know if Nevada is a good comparison,
right,
but closer states, Northwest states that are on the sales tax. How are they? And I don't want to put you on the spot if you don't know their exact bond rating, but are they seeing a substantial difference based solely on that? And can we translate that at all into dollars that would be available to the state?
Sure.
Roughly.
I'm going to have Laura Lockwood McCall answer that for my debt management. She tracks other states as well and can give you an answer to that.
Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Broon. I wasn't.
Can you
didn't look at it today.
Laura Lockwood McCall, the Director of Debt Management in the State Treasurer's Office. I didn't look today specifically for that question, but I can tell you that Washington State recently was upgraded. They're AA1 and AA+.
That's one notch ahead. It's hard to keep track of A, single A, one.
They're a notch ahead, and they're in good shape. Idaho, I don't think, sells a lot of bonds, and so I don't think it's a fair comparison. I know Montana was recently upgraded. California is in the bottom of the barrel for all 50 states with Louisiana. Well, the sales tax and is one issue in terms of the diversity of revenue. There's also how they manage their budget, also whether their capital needs. And so there's a whole lot of things in governance structure that go into that analysis of your credit rating, as well as the economy as a whole. So while it's important as a component, it's not the only one, so I don't think you can make a direct correlation.
Right.
In general, the Pacific Northwest has been doing really well compared to the rest of the country economically. And in general, you know, we're sort of in that pack that are benefiting by globalization. And we seem collectively to be doing better with our credit ratings except for California.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Anything to add?
No, I just want to thank you again for the opportunity to come before you, and again, thank you for your leadership, and have a good Labor Day.
Thank you. You do the same. You've earned it.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, you want to take the next one?
Thank you. It's 11 o'clock, and it's time for the review of revenue measures passed in the 2007 session. And I assume that's Paul. Thank you.
In fact, I'm the first part of that, Mr. Chair. Let me just say something briefly about the schedule with the two committees. We do have now until noon to talk with you about the measure summary, the 07 session, we have a large document for you, which is this revenue measures passed. We've been working diligently on that and have that. This is just released today. At noon, we have our Senate committee continuing on and discussing their work plan and adopting their committee rules, and then adjourning at 12:30 or so. And the House at lunch from noon to 1, and then coming back at 1 to talk about some estimates we've been doing, a lot of questions we're getting over the new Measure 50, the cigarette tax. All of our Senate members are more than encouraged to stay for that and for that discussion. And then at 1:45, we'll go into the House work plan, a draft work plan, and talk about that. So that's kind of how the two committees are meshing. Our document, Revenue Measures Passed, and we've been doing this, I think, back to when the office was created. We've done it at the end of each session. It's been very helpful for us to go back when we get questions, like we were getting a question. I had a question from the Registered Guard the other day, and Senator Burdick did too, about the 99 session, the bill that had passed. So the first thing we do is go and look at this and see what that bill was. So it does give you a complete summary of that. The other thing we've done in recent years, and I'll talk about that for a few minutes, is try to put some context in terms of the policy decisions that you've made during the regular session, and that's the overview part that you see at the beginning. So what I'd like to do today is talk about that with you and maybe remind you of some things that was kind of underlying some of the decisions, but also I think it's a good gives you a good sense of kind of where some of the interim work will be, and probably some of the 09 work as well, because a lot of these major forces are out there and will continue to shape policy. And then I've asked Chris to walk through with you again kind of a discussion of our omnibus bill, House Bill 3201, which was largely shaped in the Senate. And then that has a lot of the policy decisions that you made rolled into that. So I thought it'd be worthwhile maybe to go through the different pieces of that and see where there might be some areas where we may have to do some further work. And then finally, Steve Meyer will come in and talk about the school finance situation. He's got his run for you to talk about the individual districts, how the school improvement fund and how the state school fund is distributed, and some of the kind of an overall school finance situation, our local revenue estimates, for example. Okay, the first thing I was going to talk about is a little handout called Revenue Measures Passed. And it's just a PowerPoint piece, and I'll just walk through some of these with you, which highlights some of the pieces that are in the big document. I originally gave this as a presentation to the county assessors meeting in Bend. That's why I had those little mountains there. If you look at the first page, what I try to do was link back to the things that were really kind of underlying the decisions you made. And I think first and foremost, and you heard the discussion this morning, was the recovering economy. As Laura said, you know, the Northwest has done very well over the last couple of years. But keep in mind, Northwest was the real laggard in the early part of this decade. We had a period of 2 years where Washington and Oregon were consistently 49 and 50 in the unemployment rate. So it did take us a while to come to the party in terms of the recovery. The national economic expansion actually began in November of 2001. That's when the recession ended. So it took us, we had three negative years of employment, 01, 02, and 03.
the first time that had happened since the early 80s. So it wasn't until 04 that we began to see some actual employment growth. And that's averaged right around 3%. So that recovering economy, combined with the return, and the Treasurer was talking about the return on some of the state funds, and of course what's happened is those returns on capital assets have led to increased income tax returns. And that's what's been generating the growth. We see some of the same elements, certainly not to the degree we saw in the early part of the, at the last end of the 1990s, but some of the elements, gains in capital gains income is up over 50% 2006 last year, the Schedule E income, income that's associated with the more volatile components of the economy, and that's growing, and of course those far exceeded expectations, and what you had was an economy and an income tax system that is responding to that growth. And again, that's, we've learned that lesson a number of times. When the economy does well, the income tax does very well. And we continue to kind of look back on that elasticity, and we still assume it's around 1.2 in the long term, which means that when the economy goes up 10%, you're going to see a 12% increase in revenue. So that kind of growth is pretty responsive compared to other states. Most states with sales tax as a key element to their revenue mix are not growing as fast in terms of their revenue. So we're in a position to see that, Washington being a good example. So that shaped, clearly the budget allowed you to do a lot of things with the budget. When we add up the numbers on the general fund lottery increases, pulling out the stability funds, the increase is about 21% compared to 05-07. So keep in mind that in 05-07, you had a surge in revenue, but your spending was up 13%, whereas revenue was up about 25%. So you have these big balances to carry forward, and that's what allowed you to increase the budget by 21%. It was from those ending balances from unanticipated revenue. If you look at revenue growth in this biennium, it's only about 11% the general fund projected to be. Of course, the kicker knocks that down even further. If you factor that in, it's only about 2%. That was a key factor. Secondly, you spent a lot of time on dealing with the energy markets, and we'll go through some of those decisions. Of course, the price of oil going over $70 a barrel. Our expectations and forecasts are that that's probably not going to come down. It's not going to be a late 70s kind of period where we saw a drop off and a response from the markets. Is probably unlikely to happen, and that suggests that this is a long-term issue in terms of what kind of alternative energy there may be and what kind of conservation there may be to save on that resource.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler.
I, in that regard, I thought it was interesting when the economists that were here earlier from the Office of Economic Analysis were talking about, well, goodness, what happens when the price of gasoline hits $4? That was a question I asked a few years ago. Well, goodness, what happens when it hits a dollar, and then two, and then three? It does not appear to have slowed down Americans' driving habits. Thank you.
We do, Vice Chair Butler's comment, I think is very true. It has not had the impact we had anticipated. But on the other hand, we know that prices do affect behavior. I mean, that's Econ 101, and we know eventually it will limit it will eventually cause some reduction in consumption. And so that transition period is the one that's hard to predict and how long that'll take.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Stark.
Just to follow up on Representative Butler's comments, I had the opportunity to participate yesterday in a transportation discussion in the governor's office and a subsequent press conference dealing with transportation issues. And the information we received from the Department of Transportation is that VMT is down in Oregon. And the ability of us to maintain our spending based on the amount of revenue coming in the Highway Trust Fund is not continuing to increase as projected, but it's maybe increasing, but at a much slower rate than projected, and to a certain extent flat. So there is some impact, and part of that is the high cost of fuel, and also as it relates to the Transportation Trust Fund, or Highway Trust Fund, alternative fuels and hybrid vehicles. But just to insert that into this conversation.
Just to continue on kind of the list there, no real surprises. I think the war in Iraq has really opened up the whole issue for us in terms of the revenue committee and revenue discussions on how we tax active duty military personnel and veterans, and those questions you've dealt with in the last two sessions. Rising health care costs not only drive things like provider taxes that you've looked at, but also, of course, have had a huge impact on the budget through the education budget in particular. The tax gap, number of states have launched efforts, starting really with California about 4 years ago, and the IRS really prior to that. And we've seen a number of states look at the tax gap. How can you reduce the difference between the theoretical amount of taxes you can raise from your tax laws, if fully enforced, versus what you are raising? And finally, the federal timber payments issue continues to be there, and I remember that involved a lot of discussion during the session.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I have to get used to that. And so I just wanted to make this comment at some point, and because the rising health care costs is on this sheet, I'm going to say it now, that one of the things that occurs to me, and it's probably something that other committees than this will have more to say about, but the really shocking statistics that came out earlier this week as a result of the national census that was done that show Oregon moving closer to the top of the list of states that have high proportions of our population uninsured for health care, particularly children, and that group is coming almost exclusively from workers, people who are employed, I think really behooves us on this committee and certainly the health care committees to be looking at any changes we can think of that will encourage people to be able to stay insured or employers to be able to continue to provide health insurance for their workers, because that, you know, as much good news as we've heard this morning, that's some of the worst news I think we've heard as a state in a long time, is I think we're approaching 18% of our population now is uninsured, and that's really cause for concern. So I did just want to throw that out there so that we don't lose that in this discussion.
Thank you.
If you look at the next page, page 3 there on the response, what I've tried to do is look at some of the major decisions you made and tie them back to those particular forces out there. Of course, the first was in terms of the budget we've already talked about. The K-12 operating revenue up by 17.7%. That would include the school revitalized school improvement fund, and Steve will go through those numbers with you. On energy prices, House Bill 2210 on the biofuels credits, and then, of course, the expanded business and residential energy credits, which you ended up putting into House Bill 3201. There was the tax credit for the diesel, the clean diesel engines or new diesel engines, which was actually an extension of a sunset. It was also in House Bill 3201, as are a number of these elements, and that's why Chris will walk through that with you again to answer any questions you have. In terms of the response to veterans, as you recall, there was the increase in the military pay deduction that had not been increased since the early 70s and basically was doubled from $3,000 to $6,000, really at the request of the military department. The credit for veterans at the for the veterans home in the Dalles area. TRICARE was an experiment, and that's something that we'll have to monitor and see what kind of response, because frankly we're kind of guessing at what kind of response we'll get to this credit. Remember, it offers a higher credit in the first year and then goes down, but for physicians to accept TRICARE insurance, which is the veterans insurance, and see if there can't be some critical mass there and acceptance, which would make health care more available to veterans. And then there was some cleanup legislation revolving around the definitions of different levels of active military personnel that were part of that. The health care changes, the provider taxes, both the long-term care provider and the hospital provider taxes, you put into House Bill 3057. That raised about $220 million from current law. mostly that from Sunset, extending Sunsets. The Healthy Kids Initiative is on the November ballot. Mazen will talk about those revenue estimates with you. We do have some kind of interesting potential developments at the federal level that we'll have to monitor. Both the House and Senate have adopted national excise tax increases, different levels. So we'll have to see what's sorted out of that. But that will affect our revenue from tobacco taxes if the feds impose a higher excise tax, because we assume there will be some drop-off in consumption, some further drop-off. One thing, though, we don't see as much sensitivity to a federal increase as we do to a state increase, because we don't have that kind of border effect we've talked about a lot. And Mazen will kind of try to sort through that with you. Of course, that's on the November ballot, so that's not included in any of the revenue numbers that you saw today in the close of session. Will not be until and unless the voters approve the measure. Now, the tax gap was an issue that I think we spent more time on in 05, but actually had more legislation in 07. The Senate Bill 39, as you recall, was actually Senator Monroe and Representative Butler who led a work group to kind of look at those ways to reduce the use of abusive tax shelters. There are some definitions in terms of listed transactions, reportable transactions, and then, of course, there was increased in penalties. The one thing that we're very curious, Chris and I are particularly curious about, is there's a voluntary compliance initiative, administrative initiative the Department of Revenue has undertaken. The idea of this bill was to be complementary to that, to see what kind of a response we get, and the department is in the process of doing that now, and so we'll have to hear from them later on and see kind of what kinds of revenue impact we get. We did have about a $12 million revenue impact estimate from the bill, so we'll have to see how. It's a rare opportunity for us to actually look back and see how accurate we are. The other one that we're interested in is 2592, which required withholding for the first time on out-of-state real estate transactions by a sale by a non-resident where a capital gain, income, and tax consequence was anticipated. Frankly, we don't have any real direct data in terms of Oregon. We have data from other states. So again, that's something we're curious to see how close we're going to be on that. And department will help us track that and update the committee on how that's coming in.
I think that came with a $4.5 million income tag to it. There we go.
The other major legislative response you've already talked about a good deal today, and that is the building of reserves, the General Purpose Rainy Day Fund for House Bill 2707. And you've just seen the corporate kicker. Now, the way that this will work in terms of the kicker, and we also, as you recall, talked about this, particularly in the context of House Bill 3048, where you took the current year estimate. Remember how the kicker is calculated based on the current year liability, which is an estimate we're often wrong on, and basing the percentage on that. And changing that to the prior year. So that will be for future kickers. So, but even then, we don't precisely know what the kicker is. We calculate the percentage in order to reach this kicker number. The Rainy Day Fund won't work that way. The Rainy Day Fund, the dollars that are the amount above the close of session forecast will be deposited in the Rainy Day Fund. So there's not a risk of that. So we're not going to wait and see what it would have been. So those dollars will be deposited shortly, within the first two quarters of the biennium. And then if we do turn out to be wrong on the liability estimates, then that'll just lead to lower general fund revenue. So in other words, the rainy day fund's not at risk. That revenue will go in. So I mean it's a done deal. In effect, it's based on the last biennium's amount. So that's a little different than the way we've normally done the kicker credit. Of course, the revenue came from that corporate kicker credit, and 1% of the budget reserves, and Representative Berger was exactly right on where that calculation's coming from, that $184 million. If that, for some reason, let's say that that the forecast, the December forecast is down $100 million. So then you'd have an $84 million projected ending balance. Well, then you'd only have 84 to put in the rainy day fund because it's up to 1%. So any amount up to 1% is the amount that would go into the fund. The other thing that you did is, and this relates directly to the discussion around the cash flow, is we think the cash flow situation will be improved. It's been deteriorating for a number of biennia. Will be improved by the way you constructed the rainy day fund, that the earnings on that fund are calculated separately by DAS and each month put in the fund and kept track of. However, the balances in the fund are available for the general fund to use for cash flow purposes. So over time, if that fund builds up, the need for borrowing on the open market, the tax anticipation notes, should go down. So that's one of the benefits, we think, one of the long-term benefits. And then the other thing is the stability fund. And, of course, with each, as Michael said, trying to catch the tail of this increase in lottery revenue, each time that's gone up, that forecast has gone up, those projected education stability funds have gone up 18% of that increase. So now we're looking at around $240 million for the amount that will be deposited in this coming biennium. We're in the current biennium of 709. The next chart I have is just shows you the projected reserve funds, and when Senator Deckert was focused on this in the beginning of the session, and that you began the discussion about 2707, kind of the target that he had talked about and talked with you about was kind of $1 billion. And if you look at the 09 numbers there, the 09 numbers include the accrual of the ending balance. So that's included in that number. But you can see the combination of the stability fund and the rainy day fund puts you at about $970 million, just short of the $1 billion total. So if, again, this is all predicated on our assumptions holding true, you could get close to that $1 billion level. The one number I don't believe and would suggest that you take it with a grain of salt is that 2011 number where we're at $1.3 billion, which would include the accrual at the end of 2009-11. That would imply you're not going to need to go into the fund from now for another 6 years, which, in my opinion, is unlikely. So you can quote me on that. 6 years from now, if it reaches there, I'll be wrong again, but... I think it's unlikely given the stage we are in the cycle. The federal timber payments response, I listed some of the things, and I'm sure this will be, I know the House is a committee, Rural Policy Committee, to look at this issue. The legislative response was, remember, 3532, which gave the Department of Revenue some flexibility on the CAFA fund and managing that, what we call A&T fund, Assessment of Taxation Revenue, on requirements for those timber-dependent counties. There was a transfer of state highway funds under Senate Bill 994 on a one-time basis that didn't come through this committee, but that ended up being a major response. There is the HGR 15, which will ask voters to reconsider the double majority, which will go to a, instead of a once every 2 year election, go to four times every 2 years. And then, of course, last but not least, is the Interim Tax Reform Task Force, which is on the next page. The Revenue Restructuring Task Force, which Senator Morris led the development of that and the language in that bill. That task force does make a number of references to the local revenue situation, and so I think there is obviously a cross purposes and or focused a bit on what may happen on the timber receipts. Of course, the other references can be taken out of the bond rating discussion too about the volatility of the revenue system. I have talked a little bit with the governor's office. They're working on putting together the task force. The governor appoints the chair, and the course leadership will appoint four senators and four representatives. And remember that the way the bill is laid out, some pretty explicit a direction on where these various members are supposed to come from, what they're supposed to represent in terms of the economy and in terms of overall regions and so forth. There is a seven-member advisory board that the chair, once he's appointed, or he or she is appointed, will appoint. Our job in the Legislative Revenue Office is to staff the task force. So we'll be spending a lot of our time working with that task force. And, of course, our revenue chairs will be working with them closely as well and try to coordinate those activities on for these committees and the task force as well. The measure calls for a state plan by November 1 of 2008. So we'll be working on that through that time period, and that should keep us out of trouble.
Get us in trouble.
So those are kind of the measures that at least I would highlight, and I always think it's interesting to look back on these 10 years from now and kind of see what the issues were that were driving policy. But anyway, that's kind of for the historians. And then we've got Chris, who's going to talk about 3201 and bring back some more memories of the session.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chris Alamack, Legislative Revenue Office. And I was going to walk through, you have a one-page handout with a table that I think became familiar at the end of the session. I have modified it a little bit. At the time, the version that was floating around was organized by amendment because there were 40 or so amendments that were vying to make it into the bill. Right now, the version you have in front of you is organized by section, so I was just going to kind of go through the bill and touch on some of the policies, and Paul has already mentioned a few of them, and some of the themes will come up, the veterans, some energy, and manufactured home parks as well. So the first component, if you will, it's contained in sections 1 and 7, is the increase the active duty pay subtraction to $6,000. Prior law had that at $3,000, and it's not indexed to inflation, and had been at $3,000 for a number of years, and that was doubled to $6,000. And that's for active duty pay for performances for work performed in Oregon. Active duty pay outside of Oregon is already fully subtractable. The next component would allow the income from military department personnel who work at the Oregon National Guard Youth Challenge Program to be eligible for the active duty pay subtraction. So up to $6,000 of income earned under those performances would be subtracted as well. So it's kind of part of the active duty subtraction. The next component that rounds out the veterans theme for the bill is a credit of up to $5,000 for physicians who provide medical care to residents of an Oregon veterans home. The structure of the credit is $1,000 for every 8 residents that are served, up to a maximum of $5,000. I think I spoke to Son about the veterans. The next two pieces relate to TRICARE, and there was a lot of testimony about the health care of the veterans and the difficulty that they had getting coverage under TRICARE, and the reimbursements from TRICARE are based on the Medicaid reimbursements, and a lot of physicians won't participate in TRICARE. So these incentives were intended to induce a lot of medical providers to start taking TRICARE payments. And there are three components to the tax incentives, and for new providers, they're eligible for a $2,500 credit in the first year in their initial year of taking TRICARE and participating in that system. And then other years, they're allowed a $1,000 credit. So they're not allowed to take both credits in the same year, so they get the $2,500 credit and the $1,000 credit. There is also a 2-year subtraction for payments received under TRICARE. So for the first 2 years that a medical provider is taking TRICARE payments, they get to subtract those payments from their taxable income. One thing I should mention here, I've been talking with the Office of Rural Health as they're starting to go through their rules process and trying to implement the language here, and they're talking to TRICARE about the providers that would be involved, and they're also interpreting the language, and we've had some discussions about the interpretation of the number of providers that are eligible for these tax incentives. Now, the intent, the original drafting of 3197 would have allowed all medical providers who accept this to get these tax incentives, but the cost was pretty high, so the number of certifications was phased in. And so as you recall, the intent was that in the first year, 2008, 500 providers would be allowed, and then an additional 500 in 2009, and then an additional 500 in 2010, so you'd have 500, 1,000, 1,500, so it would kind of ramp up that way. There's some question, their Office of Rural Health, and they're still working through this, may not be interpreting it that way. They may be interpreting it as literally just $500 certifications per year. And part of the question may be around the definition of a certification. The bill doesn't explicitly say that somebody is certified 1 year and it's limited to a 1 year certification. And the Office of Rural Health is apparently, or at least, again, all of these discussions are ongoing as they're implementing the rules process. They are interpreting it, or at least the possibility of interpreting it, as each certification is limited to 1 year, so that the same 500 physicians or medical providers would have to sign up in each year. And if that's the interpretation, it wouldn't allow for the, necessarily allow for the ramp up over time. So that's just something to be aware of as we move forward.
Mr. Chair, if I just, that's a good, Chris and I talked a little bit about this, and it's an example of the kind of things we'll try to highlight for you. And especially as we look at a February session, are there modifications that would be straightforward that you may want to consider for February rather than waiting until, for example, January 09?
Your projections for your revenue impact projections were based on the idea that it went from 500 to 1,000 to 1,500.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So, no, I believe that's it for the policies related to veterans. The next one started as House Bill 2462, and that pertains to the 529 plan contributions. The deduction there was increased from $2,000 to $4,000 for joint filers and from $1,000 to $2,000 for married filing separately. And the reason for that structure was that it was, in prior law, it was $2,000 for joint and then $1,000 for everybody else. And the new language is $4,000 for joint and $2,000 for everybody else. So that's why those two classes of taxpayers would experience an increase, as opposed to single filers. They're still at a $2,000 deduction. The next component is the business energy tax credit expansion. And this is the bill as it left the structure that made it into 3201 is in the same form as it passed out of the House earlier in the session. And most of that tax credit revolved around increasing the percentage from 35% to 50% for renewable energy systems. The credit had been structured, 35% of costs would be allowed for the credit, and it would be 10%, 10%, and then 5, 5, and 5. Now, for projects pertaining to renewable energy, it's 10% a year for 5 years. And so that's the biggest piece of that policy. But other pieces contained in that is a credit for home builders for installing renewable energy systems and designing high-performance, low-energy homes. And then it also increases the size of projects that are eligible for the tax credit from a $10 million cap to a $20 million cap, so larger projects would be eligible for the credit. And then the next piece, the next component, is an expansion of the RETC, the Residential Energy Tax Credit. And again, that the pieces that made it into 3201 are identical to 2212 as it passed out of the House earlier in the session. And the largest piece of the revenue impact, anyway, for that was allowing for multiple devices to be eligible for the credit in a given tax year. So you could have a homeowner who buys certain devices and an electric car, they'd be able to take the credit for all of those devices in the same year. It also increased the credit for fuel cells and wind generation from $1,500 to $6,000. And it also added the high-efficiency wood stoves. Those wood pellet stoves are now eligible for the RETC credit. That was added. The next component is also kind of energy and environment related, and that is the repower retrofit of older diesel truck engines and the extension of the credit for the purchase of new diesel engines. Now, this bill was also passed in its original, in 2172B, in that form. The structure of this bill, as you recall, contained a lot of non-taxation policies as well as taxation policies. And so the original intent was to include all of 2172 into 3201, but all of those non-taxation policies couldn't go into it because of the relating to taxation clause. So just here are the credit pieces. But then 2172 was also passed by the Assembly in its original form, so the same credit language exists in both bills. But it's exactly the same. It's duplicative. So the revenue impact for 2172 was zero because the revenue impact was contained in this bill. And this is the credit that's a 25% of the cost for a repower of a diesel engine and 50% cost of a retrofit for diesel engines. And that credit for the repower retrofit was capped at $3 million per year. DEQ, they certify this credit, and once for a given tax year, once they hit that $3 million mark, they stop certifying credits. Now, for the new engine credit, that had been scheduled to sunset in 07. The sunset was extended through 2011, and that had a cap of $3 million a year, and that was reduced to about $500,000 a year. Prior, the use over the past couple of years did not exceed that level, so that cap was just reduced. The next component, what was Senate Bill 635, increases the credits for contributions to the Oregon Production Investment Fund, the film and video credits. And this is the credit where if it's made, the amount of the credit, the contribution for the credit has to be 90% of the credit amount. So a person can make a contribution, and then the credit is worth 11% more than that. So it's highly used, and that was just a cap from $1 million to $5 million, straightforward. The next component was Senate Bill 984, and these are the credits for affordable housing loans, and the cap on that credit had been $11 million. It was increased to $13 million. And another policy that was included in there was that these loans are now available for projects relating to manufactured dwelling parks and preservation projects, which are projects that were affordable housing projects under the USDA and are being transferred to a nonprofit organization or a housing authority. So those types of projects can now get these loans. And the next piece is how much of this was paid for. And this is the phase out of the personal exemption credit at the federal level. The federal personal exemption deduction phases out at high income levels, and the personal exemption credit now gets phased out at those same federal income levels. So it's tacking onto the similar way to the way the feds phase out the personal exemption deduction. The next piece, House Bill 3293, removes a sunset date on a property tax exemption for the land under summer homes. So that had been sunset. That sunset has been removed. Part of the reason for that is that there are in lieu payments that get made. The next piece, 3479, relates to the inheritance tax, and this is an exemption of up to $7.5 million for the value of for farm, forest, and fishing property is now exempt from the inheritance tax. There are conditions to that. The property has to be passed on to a spouse, a brother, sister, niece, nephew, or child, and it has to maintain that natural resource use for 5 of the 8 years after the decedent's death, or be transferred to another eligible party to maintain the exemption. Otherwise, the prior taxes are due. And that $7.5 million exemption is indexed to inflation.
I just had one quick question.
Representative Butler.
Chris, I don't know whether you're the person I need to ask about that or not, but is the 2032A exemption still in effect here? Yeah, and is the 7.5 the reduced value, or is that the full fair market value? Do you know offhand?
I believe that would be a Mazin question.
Okay.
Mazin.
Right.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Mazen Malik, Legislative Revenue Office. I was sleeping in the barrack until the 2332, did you?
Yeah, the 2032A, the reduced value under federal purposes for a small family business transfer of farmland and forest land and those kinds of things. Is it a possibility that under House Bill 3479 that those could be doubled up, because this is based upon the values, as I understood it, that were included in the gross federal tax return? And the gross federal tax return could have already had a discount applied to it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think the federal tax return is the base for to start with. So once we reach that exemption level, it then has to go to the I'll have to check on that.
Okay. The reason that it rings true is because the same group of beneficiaries, I think, are that they're receiving a slightly different change in the potential uses of the farm and forest land, but it's the same group of beneficiaries that have to be included. But it still would not change your calculation here, but it could be very beneficial as. And we've talked a little bit about real estate becoming worth more this morning in Oregon. It could be very beneficial for those operations where the value of the real estate is going up a little bit each year, and farms and ranches and forest lands and those kinds of things, that what happens is that they could receive, assuming that it moves to a qualified heir, they could receive an additional benefit in Oregon of this particular piece of legislation. Thank you.
I think they probably could. The point is the restrictions within the Oregon proposed law is about the number of years. That is not necessarily true with the federal the law. So you might receive this, but the benefits of the Oregon law might be a little laid down in the future.
Of course, while there isn't the restriction of the number of years, what it is, it's a delay in the number of years that the death tax would be required to be paid, and so after the 10th year, then the 2032A is fully effective. Whereas, again, it just creates an interesting. Again, based upon what we've talked about today of increasing land values in Oregon, it could create an additional benefit for those people whose farms and ranches continue to increase in value. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Butler.
Okay. There are three other components to the bill. 3548, it was a local option for local taxing districts to provide a tax exemption for machinery and equipment of egg processors. 2788, it would allow businesses that change ownership, certain businesses that participate in the Oregon Investment Act, as it's now referred to, have certain income that's earned in areas where that meet certain requirements, where unemployment is high or incomes are low, that income is exempt from taxation. Under prior law, there could have been a circumstance where a business changed hands and it would no longer be eligible for that income exemption. This piece simply says as long as it's essentially the same business and they had been qualified for it prior, and the only significant change is one of ownership, then they still qualify for that income tax exemption. And the last piece is 2735, which, as you recall, a significant amount of testimony pertaining to manufactured dwelling parks. Then 2735, this is one of the bills that got split out, and the $5,000 refundable credit got put into 3201, and the rest of the bill moved forward and was passed on its own. And so this is just it's a $5,000 refundable credit for mobile home park owners who are forced to move due to park closure. And this essentially replaces a credit that was scheduled to sunset in 07 that was partially refundable depending on the income level and had to be taken over 3 years. The structure was a little bit different. Now the structure is much more straightforward. It's a $5,000 refundable credit, and you get it in that year that you're required to change tenants. And so those are the roughly 14 or so bills that got combined into 3201, touching just briefly on each of those policies. Hopefully it doesn't bring back bad memories.
Just the egg thing.
Well, there was at least one member who was very happy with that portion of the bill.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, just to kind of set this in your process, you know, a number of these are new credits or extension of existing ones, and they will show up in the tax expenditure report that would be released prior to the next regular session. But also to remind you that the committee set out a number of performance measures in these, in particular the energy credits. We work closely with the Department of Energy to do that. So we'll be kind of monitoring those, and that's a good thought when we work through the interim to have them come back and see if we've got some early indication of what those performance measures look like in terms of some of these credits that have been expanded.
And if I could add to that, those performance measures were included in the revenue or the staff measure statements for the bills. And for those bills that were put in here, the measures passed document that Paul referenced earlier, all of those are included in that document for reference purposes. And there are some of the bills also require agencies to come and provide reports to the interim committee. The Office of Rural Health, and I believe Paul mentioned this as well, will be presenting, is required by the bill to present kind of an ongoing annual status report of how these policies are taking shape, how they're being implemented, are they having the desired or the intended effects.
Great. And Senator Monroe.
Just to clarify, on the TRICARE credits, I remember the discussion on this. I remember, the testimony that we got that the federal payments were insufficient to give an incentive for physicians to provide care for our veterans. I remember clearly that we intended this to be cumulative over time. Mm-hmm. And so if we need clarification, I would certainly support that. And in the February 08 session, that's something that we could clarify, because I think our intent was very clear here, and if it's not being applied that way, then we need to make sure that it gets fixed.
Mm-hmm. Senator Morris?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Exemptions and credits are given for a variety of reasons, maybe social, environmental, economic, revenue. With respect to the performance measurements, and I didn't track this closely in terms of this last session, for example, the film and video, the representation is made that the return far exceeds the revenue impact. Will that be tracked as a part of that measure so that we know, in fact, because this whole discussion about tax credits and their impacts, and do they actually achieve the intended purpose, is that follow-up going to be made?
Senator Morris, we can track that. We know what the credits were issued. We can get a good handle on, how the industry changed. What was the, what was employment in the industry? We can approximate what the tax impacts would be, income tax collections. And so we can go through and do an analysis of that. The one thing we can't prove or disprove is causality. And that's where we always kind of run into some arguments with proponents, is that we can never say that this film was filmed in Oregon because of this credit. We can say that it was here and it happened and they got the credit, but we can't say for sure that it wouldn't have happened without the credit. So that's why we assign a revenue impact to these kind of changes. We just simply don't have the ability to do that. So that's part of our revenue impact. But yes, we can follow up on that. We can track through, you know, the size of the credit and the amount of employment, and we can approximate the amount of revenue that came in as a result of that activity.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair.
I wanted to follow up on Senator Monroe's comment about the TRICARE, and I guess there's some confusion about whether it's, you know, 500 each year or whether it's a cap of 500. And I frankly don't remember the intent, but I did have a question. In the performance measures, are the is it going to be they get a credit of $2,500 for the first year and $1,000 in out years just for taking patients. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, part of that involves the providers are required to actively participate in the system. And for non-rural providers, they're required to actively participate and see 10 patients a year. There's a minimum of 10 patients per year. In rural areas, that number 10 doesn't exist. I mean, it can be one in rural areas. Again, it all gets back to encouraging the medical providers to provide the healthcare services for the veterans. The definition, part of the rules process will be for the Office of Rural Health to grapple with the definition, the notion of actively participates. There's obviously a lot of directions that can go. I mean, the intent clearly isn't to have a provider who sees 10 patients a year for 5 minutes and doesn't really provide the medical services. That clearly is not the intent that you had.
And that's the way I would see it, too, and I'd be very interested in a performance measure because I don't want to give a $2,500 tax credit to 1,500 people to see one patient when I could be giving it to, you know, 500 people to see the kind of caseload that you would expect if they were serious. So I would hope that would be incorporated into the performance measures to make sure that we're getting our money's worth for our tax dollars and people aren't just doing some kind of pro forma function just to get the tax credit.
And Madam Chair, to follow up on that, I believe that was part of the intent of the Assembly having that annual report required. That's in the statute. So the Office of Rural Health is required to report to these committees. I believe it's an October 1 of every year. It's a fall date. So probably not this annual meeting, but maybe the December meeting, they'd be able to report on information. Now, in the first meeting, December 1, 2008, they probably won't have a lot of information at that time, but it'll definitely they're going through the process right now to grapple with these questions on to make sure that the intent of the legislature is followed, and so I think your concerns are well founded.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the report.
Sure.
And I understand we're going to hear from Steve. Is that right? Mm-hmm. On the school formula.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members, for the record, Steve Meyer, Legislative Revenue Office. In your packet, you have two items dealing with school finance. One, the 2007 school finance legislation, funding and distribution. Don't intend to go through that, but it's available. It incorporates all of the legislative changes and funding bills into one document. And then you also have the school formula revenue summary that I'll make a couple comments on. That's an update from what you had during the session for House Bill 5520 that appropriated funds to the state school fund. The bills that I want to touch on are in the summary packet, but I want to go quickly in a different order. For school districts, the main bill that changed the school revenue formula a little bit was to increase the high-cost disability grant total that could be funded statewide. It was $12 million. That was raised to $18 million. So that will cover the costs that are above the $30,000 minimum per disability student. So initially for 07-08, perhaps for 08-09, that will be enough to fund at 100% of those high disability costs. Another change to the formula that wasn't enacted this session, but by the 05 session and just had a delayed starting date, was an increase to the facility grant statewide from $17.5 million to $25 million per biennium. So that will affect the 07-08 and 08-09 numbers a little bit. Two other bills that are related, Senate Bill 550 extended the sunset on the federal timber-related revenue in the school formula, the revenue from the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act. It was discovered fairly late in the session that there was a sunset date on that initial legislation to correspond to when the Secure Rural Schools Act was to sunset. And so when Congress extended that a year, Senate Bill 550 extended the legislation that clarified that it would go to school districts and would be included as local revenue in the school equalization formula. And then House Bill 2040 did a couple of things. One that affects school districts, one it sunset the small high school dollars in 2012. That's the $2.5 million that gets distributed to small school districts with small high schools outside the school equalization formula. And then it also required that the interim revenue committees study small school districts and small ESDs, their funding, and whether what the adequacy of that funding is. So that will be something that you can discuss this afternoon when you talk about your work plans. Another change outside the formula was to increase the local option property taxes allowed from $750 to $1,000 on a per student basis and from 15% to 20% of formula revenue. On that basis, before that revenue would be included in local formula revenue. So a little more leeway there for revenue outside the formula. There was also in House Senate Bill 1036 a new source of revenue for school districts. That was the construction tax revenue bill that allowed school districts to impose a tax on new construction up to $1 for residential construction and up to 50 cents per square foot for non-residential construction, and also had a $12,000 overall limit for non-residential construction. On the education district side, House Bill 2040 also increased the minimum allocation to an ESD from a little less than $950,000 to $1 million. There's five ESDs that were affected by that. So had an increase of about little over $50,000 per year per ESD. There was also for ESDs, with the funding of the School Improvement Fund this time, ESDs were given a share of that School Improvement Fund money, of that $260 million. Before, when the School Improvement Fund had money in it, it all went to school districts. So now it's being shared with ESDs. What was unique this session in terms of ESDs and use of state school fund dollars was that there was money set aside from money that was to go to ESDs for 10th grade assessment tests. Normally, money that comes out of the state school fund that goes for a purpose other than directly to school districts or ESDs is specified separately. But in this case, after the money is allocated to ESDs, then out of their portion comes that $550,000 per year. Don't ask me why. That's the way it was drafted and passed. That was the bill also that repealed SIM and CAM and had quite a few other components to it.
And that bill didn't come to the Revenue Committee, did it?
No. Several of these did not come to the Revenue Committee.
We would have fixed those things if they'd come here. Yeah.
Well, maybe.
Maybe.
And then the other one I want to mention is House Bill 3141. Again, not in this committee, but it set the limit for various programs and expanded the number of programs that are funded out of the state school fund before dollars start flowing to school districts and ESDs. Before, there were, in 05, there were two of those. In 07, there was nine of them. Relatively small amounts, but still it's may or may not become a trend to keep increasing the number of uses of the state school fund before there's an allocation to school districts and ESDs. And those, that's listed on page 3 of the research report if you wanted to see that, where what all those uses were. Then you had the appropriation bills, House Bill 5020, the $5.9 billion for the state school fund, and 5021, the $260 million for the school improvement fund. And then House Bill 3344 allocated 50% of the economic development fund ending balance to the education stability fund and dedicated it to the subaccount for capital. So those were the main education bills. What I wanted to do is just make a couple comments about the distribution and note the changes from what you had or what you saw when House Bill 5020 passed during the session. Most of the assumptions driving the numbers did not change. What did change was the incorporation of the high-cost disability grant going up to $18 million. So that's incorporated in here. And then for the school improvement fund, you'll see that for on the ESD page, the last page, I believe it is, that there's now dollars for ESD school improvement funds. That did not show up in the House Bill 5020 school simulation numbers. To close, I guess what I want to say about this is that there was no change to the assumptions for local revenue, primarily property tax revenue. After your discussion this morning, you may wonder, well, should there be? Two comments about that. One, remember that 07-08 value has already been set. It's what happened in 2006. So it's what's happening in calendar 2007 right now that may affect 08-09 local revenue for school districts. The other thing that is that the 08-09 assumption for growth in assessed value is less than for 07-08. So we've already built into the numbers a decreased growth in assessed value in the second year of the biennium. Now, whether it's enough is another issue. But it is, the direction, I think, will be correct. It's just a matter of the accuracy of the magnitude of that direction that may have to be dealt with. So, and that probably won't be updated until after November when we start getting property tax data in from the assessors on 07-08 and in preparation for the special session in February.
Mr. Chair? Yep. Senator Burdick.
Are you talking about a decrease in growth below the 3% cap?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick,
no,
we're not. The growth rate is above 3% because of the existing property will grow about 3%. In spite of the slowdown in market value, we're talking about assessed value, which is
correct,
generally below market value. So that will grow 3%. The issue is how much new construction will drive growth above that 3%. And we're saying that growth above 3% will be lower in the second year than in the first year of the biennium. That's already built in.
How closely does the projection that we are using correspond to the estimates that come from the state economists that we heard this morning?
Sure.
Chair Barnhart.
Recognizing they're measuring slightly different things.
Definitely measuring different things. What I have not seen yet is some of the detail to the forecast this morning to see how that compares to the May forecast and whether that then would warrant further review of our assumptions going forward. But we use their numbers on housing starts, construction, employment, interest rate, et cetera, to do our assumptions for property tax revenue and local revenue in general.
Thank you. Other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burke.
Thank you. On the research report on page 3, where it talks about outside the formula use of funds, I don't understand. It said that only two were previously funded from this source, virtual school and older youth correction students. But then it says that previously youth correction students older than 21 were counted with the other youth correction students. I don't understand what you're saying here. Is it new policy from these bills to put the 21-year-olds, 21-plus-year-olds outside the formula? Is that new policy?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that's correct. They were included in the school formula, and it was decided to do it separately from now beginning in this biennium.
And what did that come through here? I don't remember seeing that.
It did not.
Okay. Because that's a big chunk of dough. Thank you.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the list of allocations by school. And I'm wondering, we have our performance goals for our tax credits. And I'm wondering within the state school fund, if we do the same thing for targeted dollars, in particular our small school grants. And I'm wondering where in our legislative process we examine how we're doing for kids in extremely small school districts and whether or not we're doing the right thing by keeping these multiple small school districts. One of the things that grabs my attention is on page 3, Harney County, for instance, has seven separate school districts which combined have as many students as a very small elementary school in many of our other districts, which many districts would have a difficult time keeping an elementary school of that size up and running. And so I'm wondering about the offerings to these students and their outcomes and where we study that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, those elementary districts, yes, are small and go to the Kearney County Union High School. They qualify for the small high school, or the high school qualifies for the small high school grant dollars, their share of that $2.5 million. And the overall funds going to those districts is based upon, or includes the small school correction weight in the formula. That hasn't been reviewed for a few years. And I think that your interim study directions will require reviewing both the extra weights as well as any other money outside the school formula for small schools.
And follow up, Mr. Chair. And as a clarification for that group as they're investigating it, it's not just the value of the dollars that are spent there, but the question of, is that investment adequate in those kids? If we've got folks in these very small places, have we created a system that creates offerings that are rich enough to ensure that a child that's living in rural Harney County has the same access to educational opportunity as a child living in Portland or Corvallis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, again, I think that's the direction for the interim study. I can't recall. The Department of Education did a report a few years ago, and their basic conclusion was that funding was relatively matching costs at that time, but with the changes in education policy since then, that may or may not be the case any longer.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Paul, if I understand it correctly, we have reached our noon break.
The House has.
The Senate is going to continue for a while. I want to simply say thank you very much to the Revenue staff for the work
that you've done pulling together the reports that you've given us today. I, for one, appreciate them very much. I'm very pleased to have them. They will be some of my bedtime reading for some time to come, I think, so that I understand what we actually did in that whirlwind that we call the legislative session. And unless there's something else from the House members, the House is going to recess until 1 o'clock when we'll pick up our agenda, and the Senate, I guess, is going to continue on with their business.
We are, Mr. Chair, and I would encourage any House member who would like to sit in on the discussion of our work plan, you're more than welcome to stay, and I will fully understand if you'd rather get some lunch.
Thank you very much. And with that, the House committee will stand in recess.
Okay. Now we'll move to we'll take about a 2-minute recess here and get our act together here.
During the time we were off the record, there was some request that we consider the interim committee rules first, and unless there's an objection to that, I think we'll go ahead and do that. And Paul had a comment.
Mr. Chair, these rules are your standard interim rules. The only thing I would mention is that most of the discussion we had in the session was on performance measures and requiring those for any bill that the committee passed that expanded a credit or introduced a new one. We didn't include this here just because we didn't think it was relevant for your interim activities. So that's the only real difference between this and what you normally have in the regular session.
Mr. Chair, I would move the adoption of the committee rules for the House Interim Committee on Revenue for the 74th Legislative Assembly.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves the adoption of the House Interim Committee rules as presented. Let me just make a comment before we vote on that. Of course, there may be other comments as well. One of the things that I'm aware of is that because of the expected probable special session in February, this committee, this interim committee, may be requested to actually work on LC drafts in order to determine what bills to introduce during the session. As the leadership has been looking at the schedule for how you do a short session, it really means that some of the work has to be done beforehand, and so that would mean that the committee would be working on things in January. Now, I think you're probably right, Paul, that we don't have to have a rule on that issue for the interim committee, because I fully expect that this committee will be the special session committee as well, and we can adopt a rule for the special session committee at that time that would include those things. Is there any other discussion on the rules? These are the plain vanilla rules, and I don't think there's anything the least bit controversial about them. Is there any objection to the adoption of the rules? I don't see any objection, and therefore the rules are adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. I'm just going to blatantly advertise Eastern Oregon as much as I possibly can. There's some great Eastern Oregon onions, both reds and yellows, sweet Spanish. Over on the side here, I would invite those participating and those that are here today to please take some reds and some yellows home with you. These are great onions. You'll love them. They'll be good in salads and good everywhere else. And Eastern Oregon appreciates the opportunity to be the largest single area in the world for the production of sweet onions. So please feel free to partake and participate and enjoy.
Seriously.
But well, don't consume any until the meeting's over. That we don't.
Thank you, Representative. Lately, I've discovered a real taste for sweet onions with cucumbers and vinaigrette salad dressing. And it's fabulous and wonderful, and we appreciate the advertising.
Those sweet Spanish will yeah. I just have to tell you that a fellow the other day said these are sweet enough this year, this first crop of onion, sweet enough this year that you can just take a slice of those and put a little mayo on it with some bread and some tomato and slap it down. He said, you make an onion sandwich. And I said, oh, that can't make a meal. And I said, you know what? That can't, but two of them can.
Two. Okay. Thank you, Representative Butler, and have a safe trip home.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Anybody else? Well, let's do the tobacco tax because it would be nice to have a couple more people here for the work plan. And I know there's some more coming back from lunch. Madeline.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chair Burdick, I think, that's coming from Lawrence. Let me say it's good to see that in the Revenue Committee, on the House side at least, we have like 100% comeback. So 100% retention. So if this was a college, you'd be very, very proud of your class.
Well, either that or very unhappy about their failure to graduate.
Red shirt.
On the Senate side, however, we have only 60% retention. So.
But the new members in the Senate, you'll have to admit, are very, very good.
Yes.
High
yes.
quality.
Yes, that's true. And, Mr. Chair, about the graduation thing, this last session we worked so unbelievably tough time that, you know, we thought it's great that we send out the kids to college, it's finished, it's done, it's over. And then you realize that the kids keep following you all the time. They never graduate. Not only that, but they come back to you and they change their names sometimes. So we have passed Senate Joint Resolution 4. Now it changed its name to Measure 50 and it's still in my pocket. So we've tried to, in the last 2 weeks, it seems like I'm working in the session time. And we're trying to put something, because of all the inquiries and requests about the Measure 50, try to put a research brief for the issues that we've gone through. And in order to be able to explain it to the general audience, but first of all, we would like to put it in your hand. I'll have to say that the document in front of you called Tobacco Taxes, one of the top research brief on Measure 50 of 2007, is a draft. And this is, if you see on the left-hand side, it's draft number one. This would probably go through four different iterations before it's final. And I try to put draft everywhere possible just to make sure that this is not the final word, because things are still developing off the after session, particularly the September forecast and the closest session forecast. But let me try to quickly go through what we're having here and what's in our hands as the session sent the Senate Joint Resolution to the voters. I put in the background a quick synopsis of what the history of the tobacco taxes are, starting back in July 1966, and how that was meant to reduce property taxes for the counties and so on, and the process until it gets to what we have now. The Oregon law. And it is important, I think, for me that was to put the current Oregon law in order to be able to explain what Senate Bill 3 and after Senate Joint Resolution 4 will do. I put also the sum of revenue numbers in dollars in order to be able to give a historical perspective. This is on page 2 where you find the two tables. and the distribution of the two tables, and as you would see how a draft this in the 2006-07 distribution, there was a typo already from the 64 numbers, 74 for the general fund. However, the important thing about this current law picture that I'm trying to present in this brief is how it is primarily distributed. It was at one time tobacco taxes and cigarette taxes was known and distributed with cents and pennies, but now in the statutes you find a mixture of 16th and percentages. But however, if you mesh it all up together, it gets to on page 2. This is how it looks like going to general fund, OHP, Oregon Health Plan, that is. TURA is being tobacco use reduction accounts, and locals, that's cities, counties, and transit, public transit for the senior and elderly. And it is it's those percentages, and I put the May forecast and the gross closest session forecast. The important thing also in the picture is on page 3, to realize that as we have a tobacco tax rate of $1.18 today, this is very distinct in the statutes as two different rates, and this always gets a lot of confusion out of people who are reading the statutes. There is a 58 cents per pack and a 66 cents per pack, and those are really very distinct. They're in two different ORSs. One is 323-030 and the other is 031. And they have each one of those segments have a different distribution to it. And they come because of the process of how they became law or how they were enacted. The 60 cents came through measure 20, and the 58 was a build-up of different laws and different measures. Now, this is not the first time probably we see an increase in taxes on cigarettes and tobacco goes to the borders or comes from the borders. However, because the Senate Joint Resolution 4 started in the Senate, that it was almost governed by the process is for it to be a constitutional amendment rather than a statutory amendment. And in that sense, the issue that it has created is the dedication that comes with anything that is in the Constitution. So when it said that these to be used for healthy kids and health programs, prevention and education, that kind of locked it up to the point that you cannot use the revenue of the 84.5 cents for anything else. And with that constitutional structure, you had to find some way to do what we always try to do, is to give hold harmless, if you will, for the different uses that depend on tobacco taxes now. So this was the introduction of Senate Bill 3, and that's what Senate Bill 3 did. But Senate Joint Resolution 4, as we introduced the revenue impact for it, and you'd find that on page 3 in the small box, for the 07-09 biennium it was $152 million, and 09-11 it's $233. It is to start an 84.5 cents in the Constitution starting on January 1st, 2008. This is the net, as we would say it, and I've underlined the word net with the increase in revenue, because this is what will be above and beyond what we're getting today. However, the minute that this revenue comes in, as Senate Bill 3 would say, there's this universe of revenue. When it comes in, there is no way of splitting this is a new dollar and this is an old dollar. So the way to do it is to take the total amount and divide it into two segments. It says this is the 84.5 cents out of the total of 2.025 cents. So the separation of the administration of it becomes
in that way. So the total becomes what's important, and then how you split that total. And that's what Senate Bill 3 does, is it takes, as you see in page 4, this is the new distribution mechanism, if you will. It takes the $2.02 and a half per pack and treats them as the $1.18 per pack statutory tax and the 84.5% pack. And the constitutional tax, we divided it through the time of the session. And interestingly enough, the Senate Bill 3, there was a certain level of agreements of what programs to fund at different levels in 07, 09, and different levels in 09, 11. So we have, for example, 72.34% going to healthy kids in 07, 09, but that percentage drops to 68.47 in 09, 11. And all those percentages, all these amounts accordingly change. So what we've done is put the Healthy Kids, the Oregon Health Plan, the reduction accounts, which is cessation programs, the safety net for kids, this is also part of the Healthy Kids, and rural health, those are constitutional allowable uses of the 84.5 cents. The other ones, in order to do the hold harmless, we took first of all, we took the 58 cents and 60 cents and put them together. That is no longer in the, if Senate Bill 3 becomes law after Senate Joint Resolution 4 is voted in, there will be no longer a distinction between the 58 cents and the 60 cents. It'll be 118, one big piece, basically. However, we try to maintain the sense and the intent of the voters in the previous legislature by keeping those percentages. And those percentages start going to the general fund, 6.9 to local governments, and also in the bullets that you have for Senate Bill 3 in page 4, this is how the new scheme and the new distribution works. And again, those were basically an attempt in order to maintain those hold harmless provisions. The final piece that we had is the Oregon, the other tobacco products, the OTP, going from 65 to 30 to 90. That's a 30%, that's dedicated. But the 65% below that, those were used basically to fill any gaps that occurred after all the putting the different buckets of amounts of money in. So that ended up as a primarily general fund at 78.7% general fund and 21.3% of the Oregon Health Plan. The distribution as it looks in, as you have in page 5, five of six, the revenue distribution under Senate Bill 3. Remember, if the law or the new combination of the constitutional amendment and law are acted or enacted, you would have that starting in 1/1/2008. So for the biennium, you have 6 months prior to that, where it's revenue accumulating, and it is subject to the old distribution scheme. So that's the first box where you would have, and then the two segments of revenue that will be distributed. Once we get the money, then you have the as we said, we have a whole different thing, the 84 cents and $1.18, and those are in the two boxes below that, where you have the 84 point cents, those are constitutional dedication amounts. And then the $1.18 is the statutory amounts where we have all the compensation. And primarily you would end up with the current users being receiving the same amounts of money that they are receiving today. So finally, the total picture we put in the final box here. And this is where all the new sources of programs that will be dependent on revenues from the cigarette and the other tobacco, or tobacco taxes in general. And you have about $677 million in the 07-09 biennium, and about $768.4 in the 09-2011 biennium. That's how it would work if these things work according to the knowledge and information that we had up to the time of the sessions. Now, we think there's a lot of course, there's always changes, yes, a few changes that occurred since the end of the session. The first change you had in front of you this morning, of course, you had a new revenue forecast. The new revenue forecast gives us two different things. It's the closest session forecast, which puts all the other laws and new enactments into law, into the forecast. Chief among those is Senate Bill 571. This is the Clean Indoor Act, championed by Senator Burdick. And those are now folded into the current closest session forecast. This is current law. It wasn't current law when Senate Joint Resolution was passed, so we were not able to put those estimates outside. So now it is current law, and it is in the forecast. Now, the forecast had one more issue to it coming in. This time around, and it's probably the change is not very substantial, but we'll be able to appreciate it. The process of funding the collection mechanism and the tobacco task force in the past, as it comes through the legislative process, we used to collect all the money for the tobacco tax and then go and give the Department of Revenue a general fund appropriation, basically, to perform these tasks. Basically, the general fund was paying for all the tobacco tax collection. This time around, it became part of the process that we've given the appropriation to the Department of Revenue off the top of the tobacco tax collection. This have changed where the payments are. However, these budgets for the Department of Revenue, not the Department of Revenue only, in the Tobacco Task Force, as we call it, this is not a continuous appropriation. So it's not continuously appropriated amounts that they always come and take off the top. It is only in the 07-09 biennium. So if you look at the closed session revenue estimates and the net closed session net revenue estimates, you would find in the 09-11 biennium, the two amounts are the same. Because current law says if current law is only operative until the time of the 07-09 is over. Once it is over, there is no current law that says this is how you take the revenue off the top. You have to reenact new law. So there are these things that work in the law, make quirks that we have to deal with in order to be able to separate which dollar goes at which place. It's a very logical thing to do, don't you think? But that's the way we have to we have to do it. The one other thing that it's not here that we have to look at is, as Paul mentioned, there is now almost a certainty, not yet a certainty, but almost, is the change that we have coming through the federal law and the federal taxes. That will act as also an increase in price, and as you know, and we have seen through the time of examining these issues in the previous session. Sounds so long ago, doesn't it? Previous session. It was just yesterday. that the price makes a difference. However, those price on the federal level might make less of a difference. Elasticity still exists, but it's less. For example, if you look back at page page 2 of the brief that I've given you, and look at the table that says revenue in millions and top, and you look at the cigarette tax revenue in the last 3 years, starting 2004-05, the amounts of revenue were about $217.8 million. And the 05-06, this is when Washington started their increase in taxes, as well as the tax, I mean, the smoking restrictions. You would find a jump in tobacco revenue and cigarette revenue, and also this is enforcement and so on. And then $240 million to a level that we have not seen at this rate of tax. We've seen it when the rate of tax was $1.28, but not $1.18. So those interactions between states do not work as advantageously to one side or the other when it's all in federal encompassing, everybody pays the same kind of thing. However, just to put things in perspective finally again, the difference in the gross amounts as we see from the adjusted May forecast revenue to the close of session, I have it here as a in the 07-09 biennium is about 1.9% and about 9.2% in the 09-11 biennium. That's primarily, I think, due to the changes in law and what is current law at this time. Now, this will also change, unfortunately, because this is a close of session forecast, which means laws with the May forecast. September forecast is also independent because it might go up and down, and it looks like it's a little different. I wasn't able to see the September forecast before now, and that's why we're not able to talk about all these differences and changes. We were able to examine the close session forecast and help in building it, but not the September forecast. So, in a short summary, in a nutshell, it's not over yet. we will have probably more discussion, and by the time this clarifies, we would be able to finalize some of this work that we have now, and should be able to give you a clearer picture of what the Measure 50 would do if it does.
Thank you. Questions, comments, Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you, Mazin, for that clear picture. If this is going to be our final exam, I understand why we didn't graduate.
You're all coming back.
And for your next exam, it'll be the school funding formula.
That's right.
And after that, property taxes. Mazin, as a suggestion, you would do me a favor. I don't know who else is bothered by this, but this always gets me on your... This is a technical thing that... When I look at these, I really do kind of understand the broad brush here. Page 5, you have you have all of your charts here in millions, except the one in the middle of page 5.
Right.
And I guess it helps me if you put them all in millions.
Okay.
Just so the scale is the same.
You know, I'm glad you noticed, because I was. Doing this purposely to see if anybody makes.
maybe I'm the only one, but it just drives me crazy. So aside from the factual and the complications, and I will also comment that I am so glad that this forecast this morning was not too far different from the previous forecasts, or you'd still be running numbers, as you said. At least if they're similar. I don't know who besides you would even notice the distinctions. Thank you for this. This is great information, what you're trying to do here. It is very complicated.
Thank you.
I'll settle back here.
Others? You indicated that there's a chance that the federal government may increase tobacco taxes. I didn't think that was as likely as I think you suggested. If I recall correctly, the president indicated that he was going to veto that bill if it passed, didn't he?
Or did I misunderstand?
Mr. Chair, I think, of course, the final thing on the jury is still out, and the President still has the power of the veto. That could very well happen. It seems, however, it is more likely now than it was a year ago, if you will. Mm-hmm. A year ago, that was completely out of discussion. Now the two versions, I think, the Senate and the House passed. Mm-hmm. And one is for 55 cents, and the other one was it 70 cents, I think?
I think it was
65 something.
I think it
68 cents.
68,
I think.
Okay.
So the idea is to merge them and get to an agreement of both. Now, once that happens, whether it goes and gets vetoed, that's a likelihood. But the probability of that happening has increased, and it became a lot more likely event than not. So somehow we would have to, and unlike state law where we are obligated to stick within current law confines, for example, for the forecast and so on, when it comes to federal law is an exogenous or outside type of force that we need to look at and predict as one of the risks, if you will, to any type of.
You've anticipated my next question, which really is what are the risks, assuming that the federal government does change their tax structure for tobacco or increases the rates, what is the effect of that on Oregon's tax receipts, and what, if anything, is available in the both the constitutional amendment proposal, but are also an existing law for dealing with the revenue impacts of that, if anything.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think if you recall, at the time of the session, we were discussing the elasticity of demand based on price. And at that time, we were using, informed you that in Oregon we look at 0.6 elasticity. Literature suggests that elasticity on the bigger price increase or a federal tax of some sort is less than that by about 2. So it's about 0.3 to 0.4. Because of all these different things, we have this more susceptible to population shifts and population changes and pulling and because of the border population being so close. That's
a federal tax increase has no effect on whether Washingtonians buy cigarettes in Oregon or not.
Right.
Okay, that makes sense. But it is the case, isn't it, that a federal tax increase would be extremely beneficial from the standpoint that it would probably mean that fewer eighth graders would start smoking. But from a budgetary standpoint, it would also result in lower tax receipts than we otherwise would have predicted because of the smaller unit volume that elasticity that you refer to would cause.
Well, that's true, Mr. Chair. Again, the problem with sin taxes is the more virtuous you get, is the less revenue you get. So,
in the long term, of course, that would be a wonderful problem to have. But in the short term, we have programs to fund.
Well, that would be your problem, Mr. Chair. Yes.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
If I could just chip in here.
Senator Burdick.
Also, in the long term, isn't it true, and do you factor this in at all? Because in the long term, with your health care costs going down from the reduction in smoking, I think, until you get to about $9 a pack, isn't that, Diane, you had those statistics of the kind of tax you'd have to fully cover health care. So if you were able to reduce the health care by that amount, it seems to me that in the long term, you'd budget-wise be coming out a winner.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That would be my assumption. Do you have a response to that one?
Well, health care interesting thing in the system here in Oregon and the United States that we don't have a universal health care, kind of one payer pays all. So I think if it was, for an example, and then it will be you collect from one place and you reduce expenditure from another place, then it, in a budget sense, it will be a net gain. With healthcare being a different type of responsibility, if you will, between the private sector and the, and some don't have healthcare, the society in general, if you will, that probably and socially would be a correct thing, but as a budget, you cannot make that reduction here. An increase on the other side, and that will be a difficult one-to-one relationship to establish.
Thank you. Representative Gelser?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a follow-up thought on that issue. And we've talked before about the reduction in the number of smokers when you increase a cigarette tax happens first among those that are younger and more and less affluent, which also in that younger group tend to be those who are more likely to have children. And since we also learned through our healthcare committee that kids' healthcare costs are driven by the impact of secondhand smoke, I think you could see a very direct link between fewer people smoking and reduced healthcare costs for children, which ties directly into what we're using this revenue stream to pay for.
Hmm. Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, that's true. The first people that would give up smoking because of price is the most susceptible. And in that sense, it would be youth who don't have too much disposable income to start with. And once you have to pay $6-$7 for a pack, you might do something else with it. There's all kinds of other things. There's the coolness factor and this and what else? All these things, play into. But that is true from the price standpoint. And then the idea of less income. However, it is many studies have suggested that the number of smokers reside primarily within lower income population. And this, so one of the studies would say the more income, and you could take the conclusions you want from this, the more income per capita the state starts acquiring, so that if per capita income increases, smoking levels decrease. And that could be due to many things, but that's at least statistically that's what it suggests. Conclusions could vary from, oh, this is because of education level to knowing the risks, or being able to utilize things differently, healthcare advice, and so on. However, that seems to be something that is being suggested.
Thank you. Others? Mazin, thank you very much for the presentation today. I wanted to second what Representative Berger said earlier about both the complexity and the value of these reports. Thank you very much. And the next thing on our agenda is 1:45, the work plan, and we are on time. Work plan and schedule. Paul?
Mr. Chair, on the Mazin's research brief, we will send that to everybody when that's in final form. So we'll email that and also to the members in general so you can look to that in the next few weeks. We put together an interim work plan that's stamped draft. This is really based on discussions I've had with both the chairs and kind of a interpretation of kind of where you were when the session ended and kind of the issues that the committee has spent its time on. And then we did some divisions with the Senate. So all of that suggests that this is definitely a draft. So it's not anything final form, but it's to give you something to look at and issues to focus on. And so you know, I know you, Mr. Chair, want some input from committee members as to if there are additional things that they want to look at.
Yes, I thank you. That's absolutely correct. I was particularly interested in getting committee input on what we ought to be doing, and in this interim. Of course, we have the task force that will be working on the big tax reform picture. And I don't want to necessarily focus the conversation too much right at this point, except to say, from a scheduling point of view, I expect us to really have a kind of bifurcated interim. The part that comes up before the special session in February, during which at least in January, we're likely to act a lot more like a session committee, because we'll have to be getting bills ready for an abbreviated session. And I'm not going to repeat what I said a minute ago, but the essence of it is that if you try to get done in 3 or 4 weeks, and you're going to deal with some complex issues, most of those have to be staged in advance, and so the committee expect we'll have some work done. And so those who have an interest in particular kinds of legislation that are likely to be revenue issues need to be working on those and getting them ready to submit to legislative council for drafting, so that we will have something to discuss before the special session. And then after the special session, what I would think of as a more traditional interim work, although we'll be doing some of that beforehand too, in which we are essentially getting ready for the regular session and working on these key revenue issues that we end up deciding not to work on for the special session, and others. And what I'm particularly interested in today is what members of the committee think of as the key revenue issues that we ought to talk about for interim discussion. They may be on this proposal already. Well and good. If they're not, let's get them there.
And the other thing I might add too, on the process and the six committee meetings, that's what we're traditionally budgeted for. That's, you know, to cover your per diem costs, and so that's where those come from. So that's a rough approximation, and that's kind of a tentative assumption that we'd have three meetings prior to the session and three after, and that may change. On the key revenue issues, as the chair said, these are just some things that you know have been the committee spent time on, and we've anticipate will continue to be major issues. The first one is on corporate tax reform. Of course, the original version of House Bill 2707 had a minimum tax and a change, and there was a lot of discussion around that. States have been looking at some time at the issue of corporate and business taxes. Part of it's taken the form of compliance issues with the Voluntary Compliance Initiative, for example. A number of states have gone to alternative minimum taxes. And then other states have gone, you know, even further, and most notably Ohio and Texas. Whereas Ohio has gone to what they call their CAT, commercial activity tax, and Texas has gone to what they call their margin tax, and replacing their existing income tax structure. And so that's a pretty much a major reform. So we'll continue to look at those things and those developments, particularly in Ohio, where it's been in place a couple of years, and we're starting to see what those results are and what the legal issues that have come up over Nexus and some other things. So that's certainly something that we could come up with a lot of material, and I'm sure you have a lot of discussion and testimony. The second thing I included there is on excise taxes, and that, of course, covers a broad area, and Mazen just talked about a major excise tax increase in Measure 50. One of the things that struck me was, and I will, I didn't bring them today, but I'll get our profile every year now. The census does their government finances, and what I do is download it, and I input population and personal income, and then I set up the state so I can rank them all by categories. And we just got the 405 data this summer. And it was interesting, at least from a first blush, that Oregon, when you look at our state and local selective sales taxes, which would be cigarette taxes, alcoholic beverage taxes, gas taxes, any other kind of taxes on a specific item, is that we collected in 0405 about $267 per person, which was 50th in the state. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thing that suggests at least some exploration. Now, I can think of some reasons right off. For example, OLCC, that revenue doesn't count as tax.
Right.
As if you had an excise tax on alcoholic beverages, it would show up in this category. If you run a monopoly like we do, it wouldn't. It would show up in another category. So, I mean, there's some reasons, but there's also something that maybe we're suggesting. We've been working in conjunction with some of the interest groups and interested in tax reform and looking at some alternatives that might suggest some excise taxes. And, of course, all of this could be in the context of reductions in income taxes, for example, or other proposals. The next item I have there was on the review of tax credit policy. We spent a lot of time talking about this. I think we had a bill that passed out of this committee that was not approved on the Senate side. But you've spent a lot of time talking about how can we best evaluate these tax credits. I guess our thinking here is that there's some areas where we're probably pretty limited in how much we can do, but there's probably some other areas, in fact, we know there's some areas where we might be able to really do some rational kind of policy analysis and see if we can't. A lot of the discussion we've had around this kind of analysis has been very big picture, very vague, and it might be worth spending some time trying to do some specifics and try to actually do some, in effect, case studies as to what kind of things you would need to make a decision and how would you determine whether this particular credit is quote, meeting its expectations. So I give you some tools to go forward. And, of course, you do have some new credits out there. And Senate was talking about some of those as well. So, you know, it might be good to try to develop that format a little bit better than we currently have. The next issue was one that the Department of Revenue has been looking at, and I know the assessors are very interested in. Back in 1999, this committee and the Senate counterpart approved a document recording fee. Sounds familiar. A document recording fee of $11 that would fund the assessment and taxation and also do a mapping. And so that has become a very important source of revenue for assessment at the local level, but it's still less than half of what the revenue they get. Most of it comes out of the general fund. So there's concern and interest in trying to find a way to perhaps stabilize that funding, because that, after all, is the basis for the system. And we looked at this a little bit, certainly in terms of the timber-dependent counties and the risk that they face out of their general fund for funding. Of course, the problem becomes, for us being the state, if those functions are not carried out, they become basically a state function, because the state has responsibility for assessment and property taxes. So that's another one. And then finally, the last one I had there was on the enterprise zone. Remember the discussion behind Senate Bill 151? And that discussion really revolved around, it wasn't so much having a study as much as it was having some kind of oversight, ensuring that there's some objectivity in that study. So the way you wrote the bill is that it assigned it to us and legislative revenue to kind of assure that, ensure it. So my thinking on that was to put together a review team, similar to what we do with the cost allocation study for Department of Transportation, and work with the Economic Development Department to do that study, and then have something back to you. What I would do is report to you on what, you know, the review team is doing and what kinds of things they're looking for, and then you could react and say, no, I'd like to have this information, or I'd like to have it looked at this way, and that kind of thing. So that's what I've come up with based on discussions, and as I say, it's certainly not intended to be exhaustive.
Right.
Maybe exhausting, but not exhaustive.
So what are some of the other things that members would like to see us be working on? Representative Gelser.
I would be interested in learning a little bit more about some of the looming questions in the personal income tax structure. And in particular, we've had some conversation about an issue that's difficult to talk about sometimes, which is the senior medical deduction. And I'm interested in seeing what is that going to look like in the years to come as we have more people moving up through the baby boom generation. And do we need to be anticipating that in other parts of our budget in order to meet the demands that will be there?
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if you've had any conversation with Interim Transportation Committee, but we have a looming issue, I think, around transportation infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And it would behoove us as a committee to explore, what... This is, I think, a bonding issue because you're buying major infrastructure, but you need a dedicated revenue stream, and everyone jumps up and says, oh, gas tax. Well, I think that we need to look beyond that sort of knee-jerk and say, what really reasonably do we have in the way of possible resources for this, anticipating that this will be, it is in my district already a huge issue. But then I have this fast-growing district with a lot of needs, certainly Portland gridlock, and then there's this little issue that happened back in Minnesota that sort of grabbed everybody. So I think that it would be a good idea for us to begin a conversation on what options that we are going to have.
Options for funding what the Transportation Committee is going to be working on.
Yeah, and I would encourage you to have a conversation with the Transportation Committee. Because
Actually, Representative Beyer and I have been talking about this issue.
Thank you.
But, of course, the numbers involved are daunting.
Well, but...
But there are some things we certainly ought to be studying it.
They aren't as daunting if you think long-term about... These are not things you need to pay for today. You need funding sources that you can bond to pay for over time. The price of my house is daunting, but I got in it by
borrowing the money.
Borrowing money.
Okay. That's true. Yeah. Others. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to see us continue to work somewhat on the work we began last session on low-income tax relief. I know that we did pass a bill that extended the earned income tax credit refundability portion of it, but we had done, I thought, a lot of good work in a work group on trying to find some ways to expand that EITC, or maybe there are other ways of looking at the overall equity of our tax system, because I believe it continues to be true that Oregon places one of the highest tax burdens on low-income earners of most states, and so I think it's
income
a problem.
On
the income tax, yeah. Particularly. So it is a problem, and in light, too, of the things that I was mentioning earlier this morning about, the increasing number of low-income workers and their children without health care, I think that anything we can do to put some more money back in the pockets of those hardworking folks and help them be economically independent will be good. So I think we could use the work that the work group that Chris staffed and Paul did as a starting place, and maybe it may be too ambitious for a special session, or short session, I guess we're calling it. But I think it will definitely need to be a topic again in 2009. So.
Well, and of course, right at this moment, we don't know what the best topics are for the special session. And if we work on studying a number of these issues, one of them may rise to the point where we actually can do something with them. With it in the special session. I don't want to make any predictions about that.
Mr. Chair, just to add, I did come across some an article recently that really reminded me of the discussion from 97, when the EITC was first adopted in its non-refundable form. There was actually the Senate committee that did a lot of work on that. But one of the real focuses of that committee was to look at how the different programs interact. So that, as you're moving up the scale, you're employed, and then as you meet these earnings tests, then these assistance drop off, so that you, in effect, have a very high effective tax rate because you're getting taxed and you're losing benefits. Mm-hmm. And that was something that that committee had done, and it struck me as an issue that that is one that, that we may want to look at again.
Mm-hmm. These things overlap each other a lot, don't they? Others? Yes,
I know this is too ambitious, but I want to get it out in public anyway.
Let's talk about it.
I was prompted to think about it after Representative Berger's comments about the transportation, the glaringly obvious transportation need. One of the things we talked about a little bit in this committee, and much more so in the health care committee, and of course we voted on it. I can't remember the Senate bill we voted on, which was sort of the big look at it. But it's sort of moving toward this comprehensive care model, whatever that model may look like. Is it going to look like Massachusetts? Is it going to look like the Kids Ever Plan? Is it going to look like something that, you know, doesn't look like anything we've seen yet? Obviously, there's going to be a funding component to that. There's going to be multiple funding components to that, but revenue components to that. But that's something I think we need to get on one of the burners at least and start thinking about. And once again, it has, you know, there's that's only one element of a much larger issue, similar to Representative Berger's, is the other transportation is the bigger issue, but the revenue piece is critical. So.
Mm-hmm. And of course, one of the things that a committee like ours can do, especially because we've got such a smart and capable staff, is to work on understanding how systems interact and how they work, how they function, so that when the political will comes along to make the kinds of changes you're suggesting, we'll be able to tell people how to do it. And I think that's very important.
That's my point.
I think that's a very, very, very valid and important point. And also, I mean, I'd like to emphasize a slightly different issue. But what are the other thoughts people have? Representative Witt, you look like you're ready.
Well, I share Representative Bruin's concerns, particularly with regard to a health care that increasingly becomes unaffordable for individuals, for groups, and for employers. And there seems to be no answer to it. As was referenced earlier, I think, by Representative Rosenbaum, the recent census report suggests that something that I think we are all aware of, that at the point that you reach one out of every five people uninsured in the state, it is a potential disaster not only for the individuals who are uninsured, but for everyone else. We are, whether or not Healthy Kids passes in November, we still will have a lot of people who will remain uninsured. And I also think that any readily available revenue sources are readily exhausted. And I think that much of the taxpaying public would admit to exhaustion as well. There seems to be a divergence here between a need and a want versus the ability to fund, and it's a very challenging situation. And as you have pointed out, Mr. Chairman, we need to be able to find that mechanism or mechanisms at the point probably in advance of a policy recommendation on that.
Thank you. One of the things that I think was readily apparent to everyone on the committee during the session was that we had a number of political initiatives around other tax issues that we could not finish because we did not have the background data to write a statute that would actually work within the context of that initiative. That was some of the, some of the discussions we had early on that culminated in the Rainy Day Fund, for example, also were far-ranging on other related issues, but we were not ready to actually put something in writing that could get general approval that could work. And maybe that's the kind of thing that an interim committee like this could be getting ready for. And you two have raised a really interesting, challenging kind of issue. How do you figure out a way to substitute current expense streams and costs from individuals, from corporations, from the state, from the federal government and others into a system that will actually work to provide health care for more people and increase the stability in our system? And that's a very complex kind of question. I appreciate that. Other thoughts or comments on the thoughts that have already been raised?
This may have been addressed when I stepped out, so I apologize. Mr. Chair, what's your plan on working with this committee, with this interim committee, with this new task force 34, whatever it is, the comprehensive tax?
You have a suggestion?
No, I don't. I'm asking. I don't know if anything's been discussed yet or not. I mean, what your thoughts are on that. And I'm not leading it for anywhere. I'm just curious if there's been discussion on what you want to do with this committee.
Well, I'm going to telegraph my own view about this stuff a little bit. But since you've asked, I'll answer it. There are two ways in which you can approach these, it seems to me, at least two ways, to approach our revenue and stability issues, adequacy and stability issues. One way is the way in which I think this task force is going to approach it, and that is, if we were writing a tax system sort of from scratch, what would we do to establish an adequate and stable and sustainable system? I have my doubts about the political viability of that approach. The other approach is the one that I think you can see by the way we've been behaving that I think there's a possibility of actually accomplishing, and that is making 1,000 small changes that improve stability and deal with revenue needs and sustainability over the long haul, rather than trying to make one big one. And I see this committee as focusing on those 1,000 different possibilities, and we probably have to examine 3,000 in order to get the 1,000 over. And I'm talking about over a period of years, obviously. We're not going to accomplish this by interim. But it's you make a small change here and another small change there and another small change in this other place, and you deal with the issue Representative Gelser raised, the senior medical deduction, which is one of those that's going to threaten our both stability and adequacy considerably in the next few years if we don't do something about it, and others. And I'm convinced that it's possible to make a tax system that looks to someone who's flying at 30,000 feet very much like the one we have now actually function, unlike the one we have now. Whether we can get there politically or not, I don't know. But I think a lot of that depends on the skill and the imagination and the willingness of people on this committee or people who are willing to work with this committee to make it happen. If the task force comes up with something that, in fact, to my surprise, does get political traction, then we can short circuit the process quite a bit. But I've been working on this issue since Measure 5 started to bite in 1993, and so I'm less optimistic about one big swoop making a big change. So that, I mean, I've sort of given away what my thoughts are about what our long-term thrust ought to be and how to get there. One of the pieces that I think we really need to work on in terms of regularizing thing, which is actually a very small piece, is regularizing the process that we use to evaluate our tax structure, including tax credits and a variety of other things that we do. We sort of put together a club during this session, and we hope it will gather some useful information for us. But we ought to regularize that, and I think during this interim, I hope we can come up with a small bill that will actually accomplish that. Maybe that is something we can do in February. I want to tell you that I want to be available to members of the committee who have other things to raise. You get in the car and you're on your way home and you think, gee, I should have said that. Let me know what you're thinking about. I don't consider this, I mean, this committee's work is very technical. It involves some policy issues, but you know, my experience with this committee during the session was that our policy differences are pretty small. A lot of it depends on our imagination, our ability to understand what's happening in other places that have actually worked for them, our willingness to stick our necks out a little bit to see if we can try something. and see what would happen if we did it. I have to say that I really appreciate this group of people and our willingness to work together and discuss and talk about and we'll continue battering away at these issues and hopefully come up with some things that actually will move us in the direction of stable, sustainable, and adequate in the long run. Anything else?
In terms of access, we're in a new building, so it makes it harder to drop by. You're certainly welcome. We're out on
give us your
the annex. Yeah. And we have the address on the bottom of your...
Oh, it's on there.
Temporary.
Oh, temporary. I see. Yes. You can see how much Paul enjoys this.
Temporary and bold.
Right.
But we still have the same phone and email and all that. So anything you need to contact us, don't hesitate. And it seems to me, Mr. Chair, from the discussion here, what I should do is go ahead and add some of these issues and get this back out to the committee to kind of look at. And then if there's something else, then we could let me know on that.
Yeah, let's stay very much in touch.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to comment that I have toured the new digs. And there's something, it's actually, in terms of walking between legislative revenue, legislative fiscal, and legislative council, it's less walking than you would have had to do in this building. So it's sort of a compact design.
So maybe we should keep that space.
Yeah. However, while you're talking to legislative council, maybe revenue would be overhearing, and they could all do work together. And it's in my district.
It's a little bit like our office.
Yeah, it was an empty building, and now it's
not. Yeah, good. Good. Anything else for the good of the order, or would you like to start home a little early?
Mr. Chair, do we have any idea when the next meeting is likely to be?
That's an excellent question, and I have, as you know, I have been pestering the Speaker's office and the Majority Leader's office trying to figure out how the plan for February interacts with what we're doing. We know for certain that if it isn't before then, we will meet at the time of the next forecast.
The forecast is actually the day before Thanksgiving.
Well, just like we're meeting the day of the beginning of the Labor Day weekend. Thank you all for coming. We will probably be meeting while your turkey is in the oven.
The other issue, too.
That's a tax proposal, Mr. Chairman.
My understanding, and I don't know if any of this is sad, but my understanding is that there will be a bill drafting request deadline November 15th. So that might be an issue that comes into play, too.
Well,
so this would be the deadline in order to for the February session.
One of the requirements of our rules is that we not meet or deliberate on issues without having a public meeting. So the odds are pretty good if, in fact, that deadline goes into effect, and we don't know yet whether it actually will or not, that if we want to prepare committee bills, we need to get that done. So when I said earlier that we need to be thinking about what bills we want to do, that's going to be very important. Representative Gelser.
Mr. Chair, as a new person around here at this time of the session, if the potential deadline is November 15th, someone the other day was telling me that we couldn't request bills be drafted until about the middle of November. Will there be a one-day bill request day? Or am I just a bad counter?
The scheduling issues will have to be dealt with above our pay grade. But
boy, that's everybody.
I expect there to be a limited window during which that can get done. So my suggestion is do the work that you would be doing to prepare bills now, so that you're ready with your concepts to go to Ledge Council the minute that's available. What Ledge Council is doing now, of course, is compiling the Oregon Revised Statutes and other things that they're required by law to do after a session is over. And so they're working on that, and so they're not available for bill drafting until later. And I'll tell you, the dates are not in my head right now. But if you have bills that you want to be working on, get going on them, and be prepared to submit your concepts in as close to final form as you can get them to Ledge Council on the day that it becomes available.
And I would add that that might be an area where we could help you too. If you've got a concept you want us to work on, then to let us know, and we can give you some input and at least look at some of the numbers and existing law and so forth.
Right. And of course, if there are things that we ought to, that fit into these issues that we've been discussing today, that you might want to suggest for committee bills, that would be important too. The one of the issues leadership is considering is the extent to which individuals will be able to introduce bills at all, or whether they will have to, or to the extent they'll have to go through the committee process. I don't want to prejudge that because I don't know where they're going to come out. There's been three or four different scenarios discussed, and the leaders in both houses and all parties are involved in that conversation. So I don't know where that's going to be, but it's possible that your bill concept may have to come through a committee, even an interim committee, in order to be introduced. Thank you very much.
I just wanted to, this doesn't rise to the level of an issue to attack during the interim, but one of the bills that came through our committee came off the floor and ran out of time that seemed to have a lot of energy here last time was the reestablishment of that adoption tax credit that had sunsetted, and I hope that we might consider submitting that as a committee bill for February. It was a very low.
We could use that $400,000 we got today.
Yeah. And have about $300,000 left
over. Yeah. Thank you very much. Anything else today? Thank you all for coming on the day before a long weekend. I appreciate it. And the people of Oregon, I think, will appreciate it if they knew about it. And with that, we are adjourned.